You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Alice and Lincoln Day, who have produced an amazing film about the impact of war on the natural environment, which fits perfectly with World Beyond War's upcoming conference on that topic. Scarred Lands and Wounded Lives is the name of the film. It was produced between 2006 and 2007 in Australia, California, Vermont, Maryland, the District of Columbia, and Virginia. The feature-length version premiered at the 2008 DC Environmental Film Festival. It's been screened at film festivals around the U.S. and other countries, won 15 awards. A shorter 56-minute version of the film was created that aired nationally on public television in 2011 and 12, and it will be screened at the No War 2017 conference coming up in September in Washington, D.C. See worldbeyondwar.org. The film's website is scarredlandsfilm.com. Alice and Lincoln Day, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. We're delighted to be here and very interested that your conference includes the idea of the impact of war on the environment, because that is a fairly new way of looking at war that is seems to be becoming a lot more important as time goes on.
It really is, and the film goes through. We can't even begin to list the types of impacts. But can you describe some of what's left behind after there has been a war somewhere?
Well, we included with archival footage images of six different wars. And all of them show an immense amount of damage, of course. One of the things that is most important, it happens, is the destruction of trees. And I think that is interesting because of the impact of war that we're beginning to recognize on the warming of the planet. And we think that it's time that people can make the connection between the damage that war is doing now to the earth and the difficulty of controlling or slowing down climate change, which is such a challenge that we're facing.
Something else that we have in there that usually isn't mentioned is unexploded ordnance. And that has had a very important place in agriculture in particular, especially since World War I and World War II. And also there is the effect on water. That's often not mentioned, but we have some data or some films in some data in the film about oil leakage from sunken ships during World War I in the Pacific Ocean, or World War II, rather. Yeah,
in fact, hundreds of oil tankers lying on the bottom of the Pacific still full of oil that will inevitably leak out and destroy the ocean if something isn't done about them, right?
Well, they're already leaking out, but certainly there's a lot more to be done about that.
The getting back for a moment to the unexploded ordnance in case of what that means doesn't occur to you right away. This would include landmines, which are purposely put down to catch people who are walking along. In many countries, there are hundreds of them, and they're still being demined one at a time, very often by people walking on them. And then there are the cluster bombs that were dropped during the Vietnam War and I think the war in Lebanon. And these are little bombs that for a terrible reason, are attracted to children, or children are attracted to them. And they go into a field where they've been dropped and pick them up, and then they lose their limb. So these are a terrible legacy of war, again, that we don't always speak of. It's hidden in the environment.
And they also take a lot of land out of productive agriculture. You just can't take a chance with these unexploded, with this unexploded ordnance around.
And cluster bombs, correct me if I'm wrong, were used by the United States in Iraq in recent years, and they leave colorful little mini-bombs lying all around for years to come, and many of them unexploded, and kids, as you say, look at them and think they might be something to play with and pick them up, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, that, those things... are in the environment and continue to make war on people even after the peace has been declared. So it's a terrible
with a particular emphasis in many cases on its effect on children.
Yeah. We're speaking with Alice and Lincoln Day, whose film is called Scarred Lands and Wounded Lives, The Environmental Footprint of War. You started out, Alice, talking about trees. There was footage in the film from Vietnam and from Afghanistan, but it was very different ways in which the forests were destroyed in those two wars, wasn't it?
Yes. And Vietnam, great swaths of forests were destroyed in Vietnam by Agent Orange, applying Agent Orange by plane over the fields and in the forests. And not only did that destroy the trees, but of course it left a terrible legacy of poison, which is still affecting the Vietnamese through generations of children. And the another way that is affected in Afghanistan is that people needed to use the trees for wood, for cooking and for building, and they cut them down to serve their immediate needs.
And how is that? How is that a result of war?
Well, I think that in war, the access to natural resources becomes a matter of conflict, and it becomes harder to get them, get the resources that you need. So you start getting them from your using them more intensely from your own local area until they're used up.
And natural resources are in all of these countries are an important factor in providing daily food. For instance, the production of food in the Middle East has been very much affected by unexploded ordnance and also by simply war material destroying areas that were used for the production of food.
Yeah, I know that, you know, a lot of this destruction of the natural world seems to be treated as a just an irrelevant side effect of war by the war makers. But to what extent is it sometimes a tool of war, that is, destruction of people's ecosystems as a way of depriving them intentionally of their resources?
Well, we have footage in our film of a soldier who was in the Vietnam War, and he described his experiences with what was happening to the environment, and he actually says, "Sometimes I feel that we are punishing the environment more than the enemy, the people themselves, by blowing up their land and cutting down their trees and poisoning the places that they live." So he saw that, and it's rather unusual to have a person who was involved actively in conflict, looking out. He says in Vietnam they were taken from place to place by helicopter, and they looked out over the fields, and they could see the damage that was being done. And it just seemed to be really so much more than was necessary to do that he felt very deeply about it. And he thought, what would we feel? How would we feel if that were being done to our bean fields and our corn fields? How would we feel about it? So that kind of empathy about the land that is unusual, I think, for a person who's actually involved in conflict.
Makes
his evidence and what he says in the film very poignant.
This man, the soldier Alice is referring to, happens to come from a rural area in Indiana, and he feels a particular kinship with the effect on the rural areas in Vietnam.
Yeah. It seems to me that a lot of people imagine, or rather disgracefully, I should say, that all the damage that U.S. wars do to the environment at least is happening many miles away. You know, or as Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham would put it, thousands of people are going to die over there, but not over here, so who cares? And yet, I've read that the U.S. military is the third highest polluter of U.S. waterways and has created 69% of the Superfund environmental disaster sites in the U.S. It almost seems that there's even more destruction done in the preparations for war than in the wars. Am I way off in that?
Not at all. One of the people in the film, professor of history, professor of, who was very interested in changes in attitudes toward the environment, said that he thought that the more damaging effects, long-run effects, were caused by preparations for war. And the United States, I read recently, I think I'm right about this, has 800 bases around the world in 80 different countries. And these bases themselves are very polluting of the areas that they exist in terms of the effect on land and water. So that the impact of preparation for war is enormous and is going on all over the world, even in places where there isn't active conflict going on.
And the sonic booms from Navy testing kills marine life that people are supposed to care about, whales and dolphins, in large numbers, right?
Oh, yes.
Yes, and not just the whales and dolphins. I think the booms that our Navy make are harming a lot of aquatic life. They're just so enormous, and the vibrations are so big that they can't support it.
There's no protection against them, really.
Yeah. So it's what you're pointing out is that the environmental damage is very, very far-reaching, not just the immediate things that we think of. It just goes everywhere and every corner, including the ocean and the air.
And it's not just contemporary. It lasts a long, long time.
Yeah.
And
in fact, I've years ago, I was in Verdun for a conference, actually, and I rented a bicycle and rode around in the area. It's a lovely part of France now in many ways. And I crawled through a fence just to get into a place to eat a sandwich, and I found my trousers were caught on a bit of barbed wire, which I hadn't really seen. It was kind of, but didn't seem to be much of a problem. And I looked at that barbed wire more carefully, and it was obviously wire from World War I.
Yeah.
Another thing left in the environment. Our film takes up some other things that I think are important for us to think about. We have a segment with Martin Luther King in it, speaking briefly about the impact of the Vietnam War and concern about the war on the efforts to do something about poverty. And I think that war as a distraction from social needs that are really important and are really forgotten when we put aside when we're at war, I think that's a very important impact that we don't always think about. The war is a distraction that takes us away from the social challenges we really should be addressing.
And as a financial distraction, right? I think it's environmental activist Lester Brown who you have pointing out that with a fraction of the military money, you could address poverty and population growth and environmental needs.
Right. Yeah. And I think that this applies to climate change. I think that it's very difficult to think about the importance of addressing climate change when we're concerned about war and what's happening in these various hot spots in the world, and especially when we add nuclear war to that. And that is coming back to haunt us again now.
Yeah, no kidding. And that is a big, important part of the film, is the dangers and the destruction from the nuclear industries. But I want to ask, because we're going to have this conference bringing together peace activists and environmental activists, this seems like a perfect film for both groups. Which have you found more interested in it, peace groups or environmental groups?
I think that's very hard to say. This is a film that is difficult to draw a lot of people to sometimes because people don't want to really come to terms with it. But I think that our film blends those two to the extent that it is equally relevant to people in both those groups and to people who are concerned about climate change. And we keep needing, I think, to bring that in and connect the dots with that.
And I think also, actually, that people who are concerned about the one are usually concerned about the other as well.
I think so. Although the big peace organizations, big being a relative term here, seem very eager to take on the needs of the environmental movement, whereas some environmental groups have been helpful in wanting to send speakers to our conference, and some seem like they would not touch peace with a 10-foot pole, even if the Pentagon is the top consumer of petroleum and top destroyer of the environment. It seems that peace and opposition to war is just toxic for many big environmental groups. Am I crazy?
I think that's been the case for a long time. People often talk about it. Why don't they merge the two? Because they're so
exactly
related to each other. But they haven't seemed to want to do that. But I think that's being overcome little by little. But it's still there. There's definitely a compartmentalization in the interest and the way people want to look at the concerns that they take on, so that those two things haven't come together with the environmentalists.
Yeah, well, we do need to overcome it. I hope it is being overcome.
Sure.
You mentioned in the film that there's actually a section in the Geneva Conventions that says you can't, you should not destroy the natural environment while, bombing the Earth. I don't know how that could be done, but that the United States refuses to accept that measure. Is that right?
That's right. That was General Guard, one of the people we have speaking in the film, who talks about Protocol 1 to the Geneva Convention, that protection of the environment is a responsibility. But, well, as you know, the United States doesn't want to feel pinned down by any kind of regulation. They want to feel free to do what they, or we, they want to feel free to do what we want and not be hammered or, you know, pinned down, limited
right.
by regulations that apply to other countries. It's very unfortunate.
Do you think that's something we should try to change? I mean, I'm of two minds because war itself is illegal, and I don't want to give people the idea that there's a proper way to do mass murder. But on the other hand, if it could benefit the environment in even a small way, you know, should we try to launch a campaign to demand that the United States abide by that part of the Geneva Conventions?
Well, I think the main problem you have all the time with this, no matter what you're up to with your group right now, is that war for a very large number of people is highly profitable. I mean, profitable in monetary terms, that is obvious, but also profitable in the sense that it gives people a reason to behave the way they are behaving or want to behave. It gives them status. It gives them prestige in one way or another. And, I mean, I've been to meetings where somebody is talking about something that doesn't seem to have any bearing on these things, and they'll ask how many people are veterans, and the hands go up. There is a lot of this. People who weren't happy in school, maybe, boys who weren't happy in school or weren't rewarded or appreciated or whatever, putting on a uniform, doing what they're told, and doing it along with a lot of other people. There are a lot of positive gains at a very individual level from going to war.
But going back to the idea about possibly bringing up protection of the environment as a responsibility, I think it might be a good idea to make that a cause. Just to get people to think that you're destroying not just human beings, you're destroying the earth, and there's a lot of publicity now of extinction of other species, and I think that is an issue that concerns people. And when you're destroying the environment, you're destroying other species as well.
Yeah.
So I think there might be something in that. Certainly need to do some research about it and see exactly what would be involved. But to emphasize a moral responsibility for the environment in what we're doing, including in the military sense, I think would make a difference.
We might take it to Congress more profitably than to the Secretary of ExxonMobil. I don't know, but... but I think you both make very good points, but I think there are also a lot of negatives to war. And, you know, we can tell people that it's counterproductive, that it endangers us, that it costs all this money, that it kills all these people, that it takes away our civil liberties and on. But if we can add in there that it's environmentally destructive and make that part of everybody's calculation of is this going to be the first ever good and just war, or is this going to be another, you know, unjust war like all the others? I mean, it can't possibly hurt, can it, for people to...
Oh, I think it's a good idea.
I agree with you completely,
I'm
yes.
all for it. I think it's been a silent casualty. We talk about the environment as the silent casualty in our film. In fact, the soldier we mentioned in Vietnam saw it that way. And he wanted to give voice to the environment about what war was doing to it. So, I think it might be well worth an organization going at that way.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have this whole conference about it, and we'll discuss different different strategies. Do you think, though, that the whole ideology of destructiveness that says it's okay to destroy homes and human beings
is just bound up with the idea that, well, it's okay to destroy trees and water systems and soil. I mean, don't the two sort of fit together? And if people rank human beings above everything else, and you okay murder, they seem to have a very hard time with banning torture and lesser crimes. You know, how do you convince them that, you know, it's okay to murder a bunch of human beings, but it's not okay to destroy farms and streams?
You put it very well.
I think you can personalize it, too, the way you did in your article on the Potomac River. I mean, that I thought that was an excellent article, very revealing about the impact of preparations for war, and the people really don't like the idea of spoiling their water and their air. And if you bring that in and bring it in as a matter of the health of themselves and their children, I think that you're making an important point that needs to be said.
Well, I should say with that's an article people can find at worldbeyondwar.org, and related to the fact that we're going to take a flotilla of kayaks and boats to the Pentagon on September 16th with this message.
That's a really good idea, I think, the whole thing.
I'm glad you think so, and hope you can join us and tell others to go to worldbeyondwar.org and sign up. But I'm very much looking forward to the conference, which will be September 22 to 24th, and you will both be there, Alice and Lincoln Day, with your film, and you'll screen it and then discuss it, right?
We certainly hope to encourage people to come. We have talked to some student groups in D.C. Always wonderful to talk to them, and they were very interested in it, especially if you asked, what do you personally feel about this? What part of the film affected you personally? And every one of them had an idea, and there were different ideas. It's a help to discuss it.
Well.
And we have got some other parts of the film that we think might be useful. We're going to, we've made a series of short clips, 1 minute, because people's attention span doesn't always go for a whole.
And we've got less than a minute left, Alice. Where can people go to learn more and see those?
There are going to be links on our website, the Scarred Land Wounded Lives website, and on the Facebook, and we can talk about it during the conference, because we've tried to bring together people issues that have moral and ethical parameters or parts to them, and just make a 1 minute image of how this affects us.
Wonderful. I wish we could discuss it longer. We're limited in time. ScarredLandsFilm.com is the website. The film is Scarred Lands and Wounded Lives. Alice and Lincoln Day, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for talking with us, David. Look forward to the conference.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as the effects of Hurricane Harvey continue to devastate Southeast Texas, media are bringing us plenty of dramatic footage and stories sympathetic to the plight of those affected. The question of how deeply they will go into the myriad aspects of the disaster, the role of climate change certainly, but also the role of poverty and racism and the gutting of infrastructure budgets, the sort of things you explore when you want not just to report a disaster, but go some ways toward preventing future ones, well, the jury's still out on that. We'll talk about Harvey coverage with journalist Neil DeMoss, author of, most recently, The Brooklyn Wars. Also on the show, Trump's talking about changes to tax policy, and unsurprisingly, he's found a way to present cuts to corporate taxes as being good for everyone. New jobs, higher wages. What won't cutting the social contributions of wealthy corporations bring us? Will the press see through it? We'll talk about myths about corporate taxes with Sarah Anderson. She directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, co-edits the IPS website inequality.org, and is lead author of now 24 annual reports on CEO pay. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. There's a great deal to be said about Donald Trump's pardon for criminal racist Joe Arpaio, the former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, charged with criminal contempt for refusing to comply with a court's order that he stop unconstitutionally profiling Latinx people. As Color Line's Catherine Lizette Gonzalez reminds, Arpaio also reinstated chain gangs, ran an outdoor tent city jail he himself described as a concentration camp, denied women detainees menstrual hygiene products, and put people in solitary confinement if they didn't understand instructions in English. He ran a 24-hour webcast featuring pre-trial detainees being arrested, strip-searched, and held in cells until that was ruled illegal. The suicide rate in jails Arpaio ran was 24%. Compare that to 6% in Cook County, Illinois, or 9% in New York City. And while he was busy illegally harassing people of color, he failed to investigate more than 400 cases of sexual assault, including on children. One of the things that should also be noted is how corporate media aided and abetted the man outlets, including CNN and NPR, introduced with his own preferred sobriquet of America's toughest sheriff. Remember when he had his own show on Fox's reality channel, Smile, You're Under Arrest, in which nonviolent offenders were pranked into getting arrested for viewers' amusement? Arpaio was a frequent guest of CNN's Lou Dobbs, with a chummy relationship with Larry King. But, as reporter Aura Bogado wrote for Fair in 2009, while Arpaio was a cable TV favorite, the Latinx people his policies targeted were not. Over a year, Bogado found, Arpaio appeared on cable TV at least 21 times, while Latinx people were included in the conversation just twice. In one illustrative instance, on the CNN show State of the Union, host John King said, quote, "We sat down with Sheriff Arpaio this week while we were here in Arizona, but we also talked to a woman named Ruby, who is in this country illegally and recently lost her job. Let's listen for just a second," close quote. Ruby got a chance to say she came to this country to work and live with dignity, but not much more, because CNN thought she and everyone she represented deserved just a second. The Arizona Republic editorialized that Arpaio's pardon, quote, "was a sign of pure contempt for every American who believes in justice, human dignity, and the rule of law," close quote. And they aren't wrong, but media might also use this incident to examine their own role in giving a pass and a platform to a person who gleefully, purposefully flouted the law in order to carry out a racist campaign. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. You still sometimes hear things like disasters don't discriminate, or it's wrong to politicize a tragedy. But as we continue to assess the ravages of Hurricane Harvey, it seems like maybe we're moving a bit beyond that. Sure, we know no one ordered up a hurricane, but public policy and political choices do play a role, do make some disasters worse than they might be, and do leave some people more vulnerable than others. So media may be moving beyond nature, what are you going to do? But where will they end up? Because accountability, translated through the corporate media machine, often winds up just being blame. And blame and accountability are not the same thing. It's not a question of who to be mad at. It's about who has the power to make things different and what should they do. Media themselves are, of course, important players here. So what can we say about their work so far in covering this natural and not-so-natural disaster? We're joined now by journalist Neil DeMoss. He writes often about social policy issues for various outlets, including Fair.org, and he's author of the book The Brooklyn Wars and co-author of Field of Schemes. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Good to be here, Janine.
Well, we don't need to cram Hurricane Harvey into a comparison with Hurricane Katrina. They aren't the same. But in terms of media, one of the things that people remember, besides irresponsible and straight-up racist reporting around Katrina, was mainstream media discovering poverty and the combination of poverty and racism. There was a kind of a light bulb for a minute there, and media outlets promised that they wouldn't forget what they learned. Is it your sense, generally looking at the coverage of Harvey, that media have retained much of that purported lesson?
I would say that the media have retained a little bit of the lesson. I think the coverage has gotten somewhat better in some small ways and has not especially improved in some larger ways. I think you have not seen the kind of overtly racist coverage of, you know, people looking for supplies and calling it looters when they're people of color that you did after Katrina. And I think you've seen a little bit more sympathy towards the people who are trapped in this disaster. But at the same time, you know, what the lesson of Katrina supposedly was, again, for that 1 minute that the light bulb went off, was the realization that, oh, there are some people who, when faced with a disaster, can't just pick up and leave, not because they are afraid to or are too stubborn to leave their homes, but because they don't have the resources. And that's the kind of thing that you would hope that the media would be exploring more when you have another disaster of this scale. And I don't think we've seen an awful lot of that so far.
There still is this idea of a disaster as being an equalizer, when what it really does is call attention to real differences that exist, such that different people just can't react the same way. And one of the things that I know that you've been thinking about has to do with insurance, even, as simple as that.
So there's been a fair bit of coverage about the fact that only around one-fifth of homeowners in the Houston area have flood insurance. And, you know, I was just watching CNN, and they were again talking about what is the government going to do and how are we going to address the fact that there's going to be a huge need for additional aid. Those are good questions to ask, but at the same time, are you also asking why people choose not to or, you know, can't afford to have flood insurance or not getting it? And, you know, there's been some indications that, you know, one reason is that the National Flood Insurance Program has been running short on cash, both because of the series of storms that we've had thanks to climate change and more devastating storms thanks to both climate change and the fact that we have more sprawling development that is, you know, getting in the way of these storms. And then also on top of that, there's just underfunding. And, you know, President Trump has been talking about cutting funding for the flood insurance program, which would force them either to scale back on the flood maps that would enable people to determine whether they are actually in need of flood insurance, or if they went and paid for it out of the program's own pocket, then you would have to raise premiums and price people out of affording to have flood insurance. So, again, it's a complicated series of dynamics that you have to look into, And the coverage mostly has sort of stopped short of that,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's just been, oh, too bad, people don't have flood insurance, what you gonna do?
It's not that it's not sympathetic exactly, but if it doesn't go deep enough, then you sort of have to wonder, well, how sympathetic is it if it's not really going to get at the root of some of these problems? Like, for example, I've heard a few times, I've heard that, oh, well, Houston doesn't have zoning, you know, but I haven't really seen it spelled out how that might affect impacts from something like this.
Right. And there's a couple ways, right? One is that when you don't have zoning, you can have a lot of sprawl into areas that otherwise possibly you shouldn't be building in because they are needed as reservoirs for water when you do have a flood. The other piece that there's been a little bit of coverage about is the chemical facility that's having fires. There's a lot of development of petrochemical facilities in close proximity to low-income communities in the Houston area. And again, there's been a little bit of coverage of that. Democracy Now! Has talked about it. I think the Houston Chronicle had some coverage of it before the storm. But again, these are things that are very easy for the media to start looking into once you have all this attention on Texas. And instead, we're largely getting, you know, the helicopter of the hour and, you know, let's see the latest rescue, but not actually talking to the people being rescued about what got you into this circumstance and what is going to prevent this from happening in the future.
Well, of course, we hoped that the discovery of the nexus of poverty and racism and how that affects people's lives day to day, we hoped that that would encourage media to look at that all the time and not just during times of disaster. But having said that, there will very sadly be many chances for media to explore the connections between climate change and its impacts and poverty. And they could be doing that even when there's not a hurricane, right?
Oh, absolutely. And again, this is the broader problem, like you say, is that the media tends to look at everything except, say, homelessness or something like that that has to be looked at through poverty. They tend to look at everything through the lens of this mythical middle-class every person, right? And the idea that you have, you know, around a third, I think, of Americans who are living either in poverty or near poverty, and that maybe we should be looking at whether it's climate change or any other issue through how it's going to affect them, let alone, of course, how it's going to affect the much broader group of people living in poverty worldwide, a lot of whom are going to be hit by climate change a lot worse than anyone here.
Right.
That never really seems to come up. And, you know, again, I'm happy to see that the coverage has not been terrible and that at least there's been occasional sort of glimpses of trying to examine people's economic situations and how it impacts what happens in a disaster like this. But it seems like we really still have a long way to go before you start to have that lens being applied to every sort of different political issue, including climate change.
I did see someone note that, or a few places note that, for example, the Texas Border Patrol checks were going to stay in operation. So people who were out of status or undocumented might be making a choice between do I go out on the roads or do I stay home and, you know, possibly die? You know, I mean, it's true that there are it's complicated that there are a lot of interconnected issues, but it just seems like you have to see the it's not politicizing it to say, hey, this actually also has something to do with immigration policy. You know, it also has something to do with a number of other things. And it's maybe this is just an opportunity to get into them rather than making that be a deflection from the drama story.
Yeah, and I think that that was something that, again, the media realized for about 2 seconds after Katrina. The idea that there are people in this country who cannot just pick up and get in their car and go rent a hotel room for a couple of weeks when they need to get out of danger, it's something that's sort of slowly trickling into the media, but it's very, very slow. For example, that story about the immigration checks, right? That was not seen as politicizing it.
Right.
You know, that was actually, I think that was fairly well covered initially. I haven't seen any follow-up on it since the storm actually hit. But I think that that's a positive step in that we can talk about these issues. Whether we actually are talking about these issues in the media, that's another step beyond.
And then also, who do we talk to? when we talk about them. You know, there's always the question of sources, and some people may have seen the CNN situation in which I'm not sure if they pre-interviewed this woman or not, but this woman basically said, people are at the worst moment of their lives and you're sticking a microphone in our face, and, you know, this isn't the way to do it, you know? I mean... There's a certain just human-to-human thing that has to happen for reporters, especially when they're parachuting in to a situation like this.
Which I think is one reason why a lot of the coverage has tended to be on the rescuers, the people who are going in and pulling people out, because that's what they're there to do, and they're not going to feel like you're imposing on them if you're interviewing them. But at the same time, you're then leaving out a big part of the story, right? So the job of journalists here is to figure out a way to tell the stories of the people who are caught in this and why they're caught in this without just sticking a microphone in them and saying, hi, you just lost all your possessions. How does it feel? And that's not easy, but at the same time, that's what the job of journalism is all about, and I don't think it's impossible.
Well, let me just ask you finally about making connections. We did see mention of the fact that Trump and the Trump administration had overturned a rule that infrastructure projects, including roads and bridges, be designed to withstand the impacts of climate change. Even as we're seeing a lot of focus on Melania's stilettos, you know, there are certainly national level as well as state level things that are so relevant that you can also be including them in this story as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I'm actually really encouraged by, although it's coming decades too late, is that there is finally discussion around Harvey. Well, yes, climate change is making these storms worse. And it took an awful long time for that to be able to be acknowledged in the mainstream media. And I think it's good that there's discussion of Trump's overturning of that Obama-era rule around taking climate change into account. Again, the lesson here of all this isn't, oh, you know, the media are continuing to do a terrible job. It's that the media were doing such a terrible job of reporting all of these things a decade ago that incremental improvement is not happening soon enough. It's very much like the climate change story, right?
Yeah.
We were doing not enough to address it 20, 30 years ago. Now we're doing a little bit to address it, but we really do not have the time to make incremental improvements to the point where we're going to, you know, really get this down, I don't know, 100 or 200 years from now.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with journalist Neil DeMoss. He is the co-author of Field of Schemes and author of The Brooklyn Wars, and he will be writing something for us about Hurricane Harvey very soon. Neil DeMoss, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
In some cases, powerful interests are so invested in telling a certain story, tell it so often and so insistently, that you'd be hard-pressed to guess from media coverage that it's disputed or simply false. Such is the case with a certain line about the relationship between corporate taxes and job creation. CEOs complain about the taxes they have to pay and make claims about what they'd do if they were taxed less. And corporate journalists aren't generally in the business of challenging CEOs. But are we seeing some fissures in that argument now that it's Donald Trump talking about how his plan for a competitive tax code, common parlance for cutting corporate taxes, will lead to millions of people earning a big, fat, beautiful paycheck? Sarah Anderson directs the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and is a co-editor of the IPS website, inequality.org. She's also lead author of the annual Executive Excess Reports on CEO Pay. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Sarah Anderson.
Thanks so much for having me, Janine.
Well, the claim that media consumers could recite in their sleep is that if you reduce corporate taxes, companies will use that money to invest, to expand, and as a consequence, to hire more workers. How did you at IPS go about testing that for this new report, and what did you find?
Yeah. We're not the first people to look at this question, but we did come up with a new methodology, which is that we looked at the U.S. companies that have already been paying next to nothing in taxes. You know, our official corporate tax rate is 35%, but many companies don't pay anywhere near that. So we looked at all the ones that paid less than a 20% effective tax rate during the period 2008 to 2015, and that that had been profitable every year, so they had no excuse for not paying taxes. And what we found was that these companies had not been using their tax savings to create jobs. In fact, their record on job creation was much worse than private companies throughout the economy as a whole. They had median, the tax dodging companies had median job growth of negative 1%, whereas for the rest of the economy it was positive 6% growth. And so that was kind of step one in our test. And then we looked a little bit further into, well, if they're not spending the tax savings to create jobs, where is all that money going? And, you know, surprise, surprise, we found out that a lot of it was winding up in the pockets of their top executives. The companies that were dodging taxes and slashing jobs were paying their CEOs on average about $15 million last year, whereas the average, which is already pretty obscene for big company CEOs, but still it was quite a bit lower at just $13
million. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, and this report is actually part of the executive excess series, you know, so there that connection between tax dodging and CEO pay is really important. Well, what is this stuff about companies buying back their own stock? Mm-hmm. What's happening there?
Yeah, that's been a big trend growing over the last decade, where if companies want to make their company look stronger without actually becoming stronger, they can take profits and use them to repurchase their own company stock on the open market. And, you know, you're reducing the availability of stock, so that drives up the share price. And it's a way to artificially increase the value of your shares. And one thing that does is it expands the paycheck of the top executives, because most CEO pay these days is in some form of stock-based compensation. And so that they have a personal vested interest in spending money on these stock buybacks instead of putting them into things like research and development or investing in new facilities or technologies that might help create jobs over the long term.
It seems to me, just going bigger picture, it seems like many people have internalized this idea of makers and takers. You know, corporations are the drivers of the economy. It's as though they're in charge, you know. So if we just give them what they want, maybe they'll be nice and let us have some jobs. You know, it just seems like a weird way for a government or a society to think, you know.
And there's just no evidence to back it up. So one thing that's really important to look at is in 2004, the U.S. government offered companies that were stashing their profits overseas and avoiding U.S. taxes, they allowed them to bring the money back to the U.S. At zero tax rate. So the way it is normally is they don't have to pay U.S. taxes on these foreign earnings unless they bring the money back here, and then they would pay the full 35% tax rate. But in 2004, they decided to give companies an incentive to bring the money back by giving them this 0% tax rate. And they were sure, they claimed, that these companies then would just create oodles and oodles of new jobs in the U.S. And instead, the companies that got the most benefit out of this just turned around and cut jobs. So, you know, we have the evidence there. That's just an extreme example of how companies that got huge tax breaks didn't create a single job. They cut jobs.
And yet we're hearing those same ideas being recirculated again, and we're supposed to believe them this time, you know. Well, you had an op-ed in the New York Times, "It's a Myth That Corporate Tax Cuts Mean More Jobs," and it's gotten a really good deal of pickup, which I think is terrific. But besides hoping to drive a stake into this particular zombie idea, what else would you like to see come out of this moment? Obviously, we're talking about it because Congress is going to be considering tax policy soon. But you have some other ideas in that piece about things that we might look at doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, people really should buckle up and get ready for a very intense fight over taxes. So I know this issue makes a lot of people's eyes glaze over, but this is a huge and important fight. If the Republicans get their tax plan through, it would mean losing trillions of dollars because of tax breaks for the wealthy and big corporations. And that would just mean huge cutbacks and things that mean a lot to working people. Like education and Medicare and so forth. So this is really important. And what we should be pushing policymakers to focus on is instead of more tax breaks for people who don't need them and companies that don't need them, we should be focused on closing up the loopholes that have allowed our system to get so perverse and unfair. And one of the big ones is the one I just mentioned, that companies can stash profits overseas, often in tax havens, and not pay any U.S. taxes on those profits indefinitely. And if we ended that kind of loophole, we could generate enormous amounts of money in a very fair way that could go for the urgent needs we're facing in this country around infrastructure and jobs and so forth. So that's one thing we need to focus on, is closing the loopholes. We should also be looking at new forms of taxation that would also make our system more fair. And the one I love to talk about is putting a tax on Wall Street speculation. So as it is now, when ordinary folks go out and buy something like a winter coat or put gas in their car, they pay a sales tax on that. But these extremely wealthy hedge fund investors and other traders on Wall Street who are buying and selling millions and millions of dollars worth of stocks and derivatives all day long, they pay no tax on that. And even a very small tax on each trade would add up to a lot for these big, you know, high flyers in the financial system. So we need to be going on offense here, rejecting the false claims that cutting corporate tax rates will create jobs, and really insisting on making the system more fair.
We've been speaking with Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're online at ips-dc.org, and that's where you'll find the new report, Corporate Tax Cuts Boost CEO Pay, Not Jobs. Sarah Anderson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, we'll talk about how creatures fell into extinction during abrupt climate shifts, sometimes within a single human lifetime. Paleoecologist Jacqueline Gill joins us.
About 1,000 years later was also very abrupt. So within less than a century, several degrees Celsius warming, which is what we're looking at in the next century today. And so these kinds of very quick events were very shocking to scientists a few decades ago when we first discovered just how quickly the climate system could shift like that.
But first, some of the most shocking science yet. From the Netherlands, Dr. Thomas Crowther speaks for a team of 50 world scientists, all warning the official climate projections are missing an important carbon feedback. As we warm, the soil will release carbon dioxide and methane equivalent to the greenhouse gas emissions of the whole United States.
We estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
Go ahead and deny it. Appoint all the climate deniers to the top levels of government. Command the rising tides to stop. And say it isn't happening. Nature and the geophysical reality of this planet does not care what you think. The atmosphere, the seas, and the soil are shifting to a new reality. That's the super tweet rocketing around the world, and all the president's men can't stop it. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
For a couple of decades, I've heard scientists worry that the warming world will speed up microorganisms that break down carbon. That could release more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But is it true? How can we test that? Scientists in different countries have been trying to simulate a warmer world to see what happens to plants and to the soil. Now a team of dozens of scientists have released a summary of those studies. It looks like added carbon from the soil alone adds a whole new need for us to cut human emissions quickly, and as Donald Trump would say, bigly. We've reached the lead author for this letter, published in the journal Nature with 49 other scientists. It was published on December 1st, 2016. Dr. Thomas Crowther has been a postdoctoral fellow funded by the Yale Climate and Energy Institute. Now he's at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. He's an expert in soil organisms and extends his study to the processes of climate change. Thomas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me on.
To get us started, how much carbon is stored in the soil relative to the amount of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere?
So at the moment, the most recent estimate of global soil carbon stocks is about 880 petagrams, and that's just talking about the upper soil horizon, the very top 10 centimeters of soil. And those are the most sensitive to things like warming and changes in microbial activity. That's really the carbon that we're most interested in.
And a petagram is about a billion metric tons of carbon, is that right?
That's right, a billion metric tons or a trillion kilograms.
All right, now how long have scientists suspected that a warming planet might stimulate a carbon release from the soils?
So for a couple of decades now, we've theoretically supposed that it might be possible that increasing activity of organisms that live in the soil might stimulate the loss of carbon into the atmosphere. But at the same time, we've also had these considerations that maybe increases in plant growth might offset those changes. And so, you know, there would be as much carbon being lost as there is being taken up by the soil under warming. And so that's really why all these studies around the world have been established and been running for a long period of time to try and get an idea on the balance of those two processes.
Well, your team studied and summarized about 50 experiments on the impact of warming the ground. How can anyone test that, and where have those studies been done?
They're conducted all across the Northern Hemisphere. Really, it would be best if we had them in the Southern Hemisphere in the tropics as well, but those are the areas where there's not so much carbon in the soil, so we're not too worried about carbon losses in those regions. But these studies were conducted in individual sites all over the Northern Hemisphere, and they all had warmed plots next to ambient plots. And so you can really compare the amount of soil between those different plots. Other research has been done exploring the actual changes in fluxes to and from the soil. So that's the movement of carbon into and out of the soil. But those are very short-term, immediate-term readings, and they give us a very quick snapshot as to what's happening. And so they show very variable responses. But by looking at the long-term net changes in carbon pools across a huge region, global perspective, we can really get a broad perspective overview on the process and identify how the total global carbon pool is changing.
Well, now the group letter says initial carbon content can be the determining factor during warming. And we know that soils at high latitudes, including Arctic permafrost even, may be deep and contain vast amounts of carbon stored from previous ages. And that seems to say the Arctic will become a significant carbon source. And yet the letter in Nature, if I'm reading it right, says an archive of previous Earth system models predicted increased soil carbon at high latitudes. Thomas, which is it, more carbon loss in high latitudes or less?
Well, based on our study, at least in response to warming alone, we would expect to see losses from the Arctic. Earth system models, though, take into account a range of different processes, and one of the major processes that they take into account is increased plant growth in response to elevated CO2. And this leads to sort of a greening of the Arctic. And so all of those Earth system models that have been used for the climate projections, they've incorporated that increased plant growth, which has meant that they expect there to be increased photosynthesis in the Arctic and then increased carbon uptake and then storage in the soil. But the problem was, we've also had these concerns about this soil carbon feedback, but because the data on this topic has been highly idiosyncratic, with thousands of studies showing increases and thousands showing decreases in soil carbon, ultimately the Earth system modelers in several of the models removed that feedback from the process. So they removed the soil carbon losses, leaving only the increased plant growth. That's why people expected there to be gains in the Arctic. So our study shows that it's absolutely critical that they put this soil carbon feedback back into those models. And we suggest that the losses of carbon from the Arctic, at least from the high-latitude soils, has the potential to at least be on the same order of magnitude, if not offset those increases in plant growth.
Now, you talked about reactions in the top 10 centimeters or 4 inches of soil. But what if we included deeper soils? Could the carbon loss be greater than your conclusions?
Yes, certainly losses of carbon from deeper soil horizons has the potential to enhance the losses that we've seen here. And certainly in, high permafrost regions, when you're getting melting of permafrost, that is going to have an impact deeper in the soil, and those are really going to potentially enhance the size of our feedback. The reason we focused on the top 10 centimeters is because this is the most biologically active area, and certainly that's going to be the largest contributor to these soil carbon losses. But if there's going to be any impact at all from the lower horizons, it's also going to be increasing the size of the process.
So will soil surface temperature change in lockstep with atmospheric temperature? In other words, if we have 2 degrees C increase in global mean temperature rise, does the soil go up 2 degrees C, or can it be more or less?
So soil temperature generally matches atmospheric temperature rises, which obviously follow atmospheric CO2 concentrations. So in short, yes. We expect to see gradual warming as we see gradual increases in CO2.
So what are the agents which you've studied which act to release carbon from the soil? Who are the characters we might meet if we had telescopic eyes?
The soil is home to tens of thousands of different species of, obviously there's plants, but there's also bacteria and fungi, the microbes that are hugely abundant in every single gram of soil. And there's also lots of animals like mites and things called calendula or springtails, and worms and beetles and all sorts of stuff. The soil is absolutely teeming with a huge abundance of organisms. And really, it's the microbes that we focus on because they are the greatest biomass. The biggest proportion of the biomass of the living organisms in the soil is the microbes. And so when they get warmer, their activity increases in the same way that, you know, human activity increases when we get warmer, leading to more respiration, leading to more carbon emissions from those microbes. But it certainly happens with plants and animals too. So just the more active all of these organisms are getting, the more they spew carbon out into the atmosphere.
Well, look, I'm a gardener, and I claim gardeners and farmers are the most interested part of the public who care about life in the soil. But our culture, Thomas, trains us to avoid things now like decomposition and smells and rotting. And I wonder if that adds to the general blindness we have for the importance of soil organisms. What do you think?
I think that's a very good point. I think soil organisms are absolutely critical to the functioning of our planet. You know, the breakdown of plant-derived carbon products is responsible for regulating atmospheric CO2 concentrations and regulating our climate. They're critical to the processing of nutrients and to the release of nutrients and to the growth of plants and productivity in agricultural systems. These organisms that are completely ignored by most of us are really the drivers of biogeochemical processes as well as food production and all sorts of other processes. So, yeah, I completely agree with you that it's these organisms that are sort of the unseen majority, and they really play a major role in our planet.
Well, now for a foolish question. I've almost burned my hand putting it into a compost pile where organisms are digesting plants rapidly. Could the added heat from microorganisms working faster add any significant heat to the planet beyond the carbon and methane they emit, or is that just silliness?
It's not silliness. I know what you mean. When you stick your hand into some decomposing material, you can certainly feel the heat. But if there is any additional heat being entered into the atmosphere, it's absolutely nothing in relation to the amount of warming that we get from the CO2 that's being emitted.
Okay, now do we know how much soil carbon may be released as carbon dioxide compared to methane, and would methane released from soils be significant?
Certainly, the carbon is likely to come out in the form of methane and carbon dioxide, but it'll be in the vast majority of places dominated by carbon dioxide, which is the largest greenhouse gas, but certainly not the most potent. Methane is many times more potent than carbon dioxide, but it's really in those high latitude areas where we're seeing the biggest losses that you actually get a larger proportion of methane buildup in the soil, in the frozen soil. So it's not necessarily a good news story, but it's difficult to say globally what the total proportions are at this moment. But that's obviously something that we're looking into at the moment.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with scientist Thomas Crowther. Let's talk a little bit about the limitations, as there are doubts about all scientific papers. First of all, I was confused to read that by 2050, global soil carbon stocks in the upper soil horizons will fall by 30 plus or minus 30 petagrams. Now, if I read that correctly, it seems to include a margin of error of 100%. Doesn't that imply this projection of increased carbon release could be wrong?
It certainly suggests that the value of 30 might be wrong. It is our most likely estimate, but still, there's a large uncertainty. But what I'd really stress is that uncertainty is not a concern here, because we're talking about processes that are going to drastically accelerate the rate of climate change. And so what this study categorically shows is that there will be this feedback. It will exist. And I sort of equate it to, if you're planning to cross a road and, there's a bus coming at 50 miles an hour, there's no doctor on earth who can tell you exactly how many bones you're going to break. There's a huge uncertainty in his understanding of how damaged you're going to be. But we do know that there's going to be a significant damage to you, and therefore that should be enough information to encourage you to avoid moving buses in the future. And that's really what we're doing here. We show that undoubtedly there's going to be considerable losses. The magnitude of those losses varies hugely, but we can suggest that for sure that the losses are going to occur.
Indeed. Please step away from the bus. Well, this fall, I talked with Professor James Curran. He's formerly the head of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, and his paper suggests biomass is capturing less carbon dioxide, as the climate becomes hotter. Is your projection for greenhouse gas emissions from soil affected by that if plants sequester less carbon from the soil?
Certainly, as any processes that dampen the carbon sequestration in plants are going to contribute to this kind of process in soil. Ultimately, plants are the main players that are responsible for taking carbon from the atmosphere and sticking it in the soil. So anything that damages that potential to take that carbon up ultimately limits the amount of carbon that's sequestered in the soil, yes.
Thomas, what about the impacts of precipitation changes like growing desertification in the subtropics or more rain in the Arctic? How does that affect this study?
So the impact of precipitation changes could drastically alter the effects that we observe here. So you're going to see extreme precipitation changes that can really regulate the magnitude of losses. In our study, we're only really able to address the warming. And the value of that is we have a better perspective on how general that warming is going to be. And we know that that is the dominant process, by far the major process regulating carbon emissions from soil. But certainly changes in precipitation, which could be idiosyncratic, might alter the magnitude of this effect to some extent. And that's why it's processes like that that cause us to have so much uncertainty in that final prediction.
Now, to be clear, in this paper, when you discuss 1 degree C of warming over 35 years to 2050, are you assuming 1 degree above pre-industrial temperature of the planet or 1 degree hotter than we are now?
That would be 1 degree hotter than we are now. But that's not what we're predicting. That's the most sort of recent ensemble member of the Earth system model suggests that soil temperature, surface soil temperature is going to go up by 2 degrees by that time. So it's closer to an order of magnitude of 55 petagrams by 2050. We'll be lost from the carbon.
Can you please explain why the effects of a given amount of warming are never fully realized?
So ultimately, the process is always acting in response to warming. So the warming takes place, and then it's within the next couple of years that ultimately the total extent of carbon emissions takes place. So it's never an immediate process. And so it's almost like the changes in carbon emissions are always following the changes in warming.
Okay. So since more carbon from soils will increase warming, we call this a positive feedback loop. Are there control factors which can slow or halt this extra carbon release from the soil?
Certainly. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that changes to agricultural practices, things like holistic management of grazing animals or, you know, the use of biochar or organic products can lead to massive scale carbon sequestration. And this has the potential to dampen the feedback that we're talking about here. And, you know, if done on a global scale, I think it has a really good, a strong chance to put a major dent in the magnitude of these carbon losses.
As you know, many scientists worry that a hotter world will lead to mass extinctions of plants, animals, and other life forms that can't adapt to a rapidly changed environment. What about the world of microbiology? Thomas Crowther, is there a point at which heating causes damage or even mass death of critical microbial life?
That's definitely an important point, actually, because the reason we see the major losses occurring in the Arctic is because there is a limit on the extent to which microbes will continue to grow. I'll explain myself. Essentially, a microbe will continually get more and more active up to about 30 or 40 degrees. But beyond that 30 or 40 degree threshold, ultimately their enzymes start to denature and they start to struggle, and then they no longer emit as much carbon. And the reason we see such bigger changes in the Arctic than we do in the tropics is because the tropics are already close to that 30-degree mark. So when you warm an already warm microbe, you get no increases in carbon losses. But when you warm a microbe that's existing in the Arctic at 0 degrees, then there's immediately increases. And that will only continue to increase until the Arctic is 30 degrees. So at least within our timescale that we're thinking of on a climate change timescale, that we will hopefully never reach a time when warming doesn't stimulate microbial activity in the high-latitude regions of the world.
Okay. Now, next, your paper says, quote, "We stress that such statistical approaches cannot be used to project soil carbon losses far into the future." Why not?
Ultimately, we are predicting changes in a single pixel, each pixel of the Earth, based on a simple linear relationship. And this relationship is really good at predicting what's happening now. But when you project it over hundreds of years, ultimately the magnitude of carbon in each of those pixels changes so much that the linear relationship no longer applies to them. And it's for that reason that we really encourage the incorporation of these data into Earth system models. And those are the kind of models that take into account weather patterns and changes in plant growth and changes in precipitation and changes in all sorts of other processes, whether they're caused by humans or not. And when you incorporate all of the information from all of those processes, it's then that you're going to get a really good handle on what's happening to every single pixel on Earth.
Now, media reports say this added soil carbon could be equal to adding another United States in terms of emissions. I had a question about that. Does that mean 1 year of U.S. emissions could come from the soil by 2050, or that every year soils could release the same amount as the United States does now?
So I think the article that highlighted that was suggesting that it would be every year the soils will emit as much as the United States is doing now. I think it was calculated more roughly, though, based on we estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions, well, expected anthropogenic emissions over that time. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit almost as much, well, about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
It's like adding a new giant industrialized country just because of this new knowledge. Now, looking at the ramifications of that, the Paris Climate Agreement set what I think are very soft goals for countries to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Now we have this new scientific information. It seems to me, wouldn't the national goals have to either increase or be moved up in time in order to counterbalance the soil carbon loss your letter warns about?
Well, that may possibly be the case. I could only argue that the increasing emissions from the soil clarify, they really sort of drive home the necessity for us to at least be meeting the targets that we met in COP. And I completely agree. Now that we know the magnitude of these carbon losses from the soil, the more we learn about the carbon dynamics in the future, the more it suggests that we really need to cut down and, if possible, get lower than the sort of targets that they originally set at COP. But it's really that understanding of Earth system dynamics that allows us to set the right targets. And hopefully we can hit them in the future.
How serious do you think this news is, Thomas?
I think it's extremely serious, actually, because ultimately our current understanding of how the climate is changing is based on models, and several of these models didn't even really incorporate a thorough understanding of this feedback. In fact, they removed it from several of the models. So when this information is placed back into the models, it's certainly going to increase the rate at which we're expecting climate change to be. And so that just means that it's going to increase the rate at which all the catastrophic events associated with climate change are going to come into play. So it really stresses the urgency with which we need to start fighting against climate change.
And along those lines, your paper calls for a concerted international research effort to track the reaction of soils to warming. At the same time, as you know, President-elect Donald Trump's team announced a multi-billion dollar cut to climate research at NASA. You were in the Netherlands. Do you think that other countries can find enough political support to fund the soil carbon project without the United States?
Ultimately, I don't think that too many countries around the world are considering Mr. Trump's, at least his stance on climate change that he suggested during the election. I don't think they're taking that too seriously. Generally, politicians around the world are in agreement with almost all of the scientists that climate change is a serious and significant problem. So I think funding around the world for climate change research is certainly, well, hopefully going to remain high. And it's really for this reason that I actually think that Mr. Trump is in one of the strongest positions ever to be a president with the potential to have such a positive impact on the world. If he takes into account the overwhelming message from almost all of the scientists in the world, then certainly he can have one of the most positive impacts of any president in recent history, I think.
And what about the lack of data from the Southern Hemisphere? We have listeners there. Who can provide that information? Where are the priority countries for this research to get done?
Well, everywhere in the tropics, really. Ultimately, we need data from everywhere around the tropics to really see if they do fit our models. We predict that carbon losses from the tropics are not going to be inconsequential, really, because there's relatively small amount of carbon in the soil over there. Because, as I mentioned, the microbes are already warm, they're already respiring a lot, they're already decomposing all that plant material. But maybe there's going to be some sort of other changes that occur in the tropics that we didn't foresee. Maybe there's going to be increased uptake by the soils or something like that. So certainly we want to set up experiments over there. And I'm in the process of setting one up in Costa Rica. We also have people working in across Africa to try and set up these similar warming experiments. But ultimately, as you mentioned in your last comment, what we really need is sort of scientific funding on climate change to really be able to get a handle on the size of this effect and to really minimize that the size of that uncertainty so we can predict exactly what the climate's going to do in the future.
Well, your team's letter to the journal Nature generated some pretty good publicity. Have you received positive interest from other scientists or agencies or even governments?
The response has been amazing, absolutely. Governments in Europe as well as scientists all over the world have been absolutely very much in support of it. And I think it's hopefully going to spur on a lot of additional interest and funding in this really important research area.
Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, of course I want to understand the world. And if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for humanity. It's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
We've been talking about a worrying new addition to escalating greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The letter from 50 scientists just published in the journal Nature is titled Quantifying Global Soil Carbon Losses in Response to Warming. From the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, we've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Thomas Crowther. Find links to Thomas and the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas, thank you so much for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been great to chat. Thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If we knew how species changed in the past, maybe we could help our current living companions survive. Of course, we need to know how plants and animals react to a climate shift. That's part of what Jacqueline Gill does. At the University of Maine, Dr. Gill is a paleoecologist and a biogeographer. We'll find out what those terms mean and hopefully get a glimpse of how things go extinct, just in case we need to know ourselves. Officially, Jacqueline Gill is an assistant professor with the University of Maine School of Biology and Ecology and the Climate Change Institute. She's co-authored and been lead author of a series of papers that caught my eye. They're redefining how we think about conservation in a time of climate change. A few of those new tools and visions seem a bit scary to me. Jacqueline, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, it's not your ideas that worry me. It's what you and other scientists are discovering. Once we start to heat up the planet, the whole stage of living actor seems to become so fluid, so interlocked, so changeable. Talk to us about that.
So what I find really interesting about studying the past is that we have this series of natural experiments in climate change, in extinction, in introducing species to an area for the first time. And what we can learn from that range of natural experiments is that there are winners and there are losers under different conditions. And it's humans, our activities on the planet are also creating a series of winners and losers. And so we can look to the past for clues as to which species are going to be resilient to climate change, which species are going to do well in the sort of brave new world that is emerging because of our activities, and which species will be at risk. And one of the things I also work on is what are the consequences of losing species? There are sort of cascading effects of losing pieces to the puzzle. And I think that if we think about climate change and the unique challenges that it will pose to biodiversity, it's starting to be apparent that we really need to start to think outside the box a bit in terms of our conservation strategies. One of the really big take-home messages from, you know, millions of years of climate change is that the idea of a community as a discrete unit of, you know, you have a whole bunch of species living together, a community is very temporary, right? So we know that in response to climate change, even just since the end of the last ice age, species come together and they go apart in many cases because every species is reacting to climate change in its own unique way. And so there's been a big push in recent years to move away from thinking of species-level conservation because it's really difficult to save a million species with individual climate plans for each one. And so people are trying to come up with other ways of protecting as many species as possible. But we also know that thinking about a community as a static unit, right? If I go to, say, Acadia National Park, which is down the road from me, I can't necessarily expect all of those species to be there in 100 years because every plant and animal is going to be trying to track its own habitat going into the next century. And so there's sort of a happy medium that we need to reach between trying to protect every individual species and its own unique needs, and also trying to hold on to this sort of static view of an ecosystem as a snapshot in time, because we know that ecosystems are dynamic, and sometimes that's part of how they can be resilient.
And it amazes me. I mean, you talk about a puzzle that you can remove just a small piece as far as humans are concerned. It might be a bug or a bird, and suddenly a forest could die off. It's also interlocked.
Yeah, it's interesting because I spend a lot of my time thinking about our largest animals, many of which we no longer have. We've lost most of the biggest animals on the planet just in the last 20,000 years or so, which is a really short period of time when it comes to, you know, ecosystems. I mean, it seems like a long time for us. Certainly, it's a long time for our governments and our institutions, or, you know, a 24-hour news cycle. But there's a lot of compelling evidence that the forests that we have today, for example, still notice the loss of woolly mammoths, you know, 12,000 years ago. And we think of a lot of keystone species today, like elephants or rhinoceroses, and they are the very last remnants that we have of these sort of ecosystem engineers that play a really important role in creating certain kinds of habitats that allow lots of other species to thrive. And so we can look to the conservation lessons that we've learned from observing what happens when you lose a woolly mammoth and then take that to understanding what will happen if we lose elephants or what would happen if we introduce bison into a new place, for example. It kind of goes both ways. It's maybe a controversial idea, but I think that there's a lot of evidence that not all species have the same impacts in their ecosystem. And so thinking about, you know, focusing our limited conservation dollars and attention on those species that might have the biggest impacts if we were to lose them could be one way of doing some sort of environmental triage.
Well, we'll get more into the idea of environmental triage. That's one of the scary ideas to me. But before we dig into the science that you do, an article in Rolling Stone magazine has you saying that paleoecology reveals, quote, really compelling evidence that there can be events of abrupt climate change that can happen well within human lifespans. We're talking less than a decade, end quote. Jacqueline, can you describe what kind of change, maybe with an example?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the poster child example where we really started to realize that abrupt climate change could happen very quickly and on very relevant timescales was looking at how the Earth system came out of the last ice age. It wasn't just necessarily like turning up the thermostat on the Earth. Moving from one regime, which would be sort of a full ice age condition, into our current warm period, the interglacial that we live in now, as we kind of come from one phase to another phase, there's often a lot of upheaval that's associated with those kinds of transitions. And so I like to think of it as if you walk into a dark room, it's not like flipping the light switch and suddenly everything is bright, with the analogy being that you're going from sort of an ice house earth to a greenhouse earth. The analogy is more like walking into a room and then flipping the switch on and off, sort of flickering back and forth. And that flickering may be a kind of an early warning signal that a big transition is coming in the climate system. And there's some evidence that we might be seeing fingerprints like that on the climate system today. But if we look back to that last period of real global warming that the planet experienced, which was at the end of the last ice age, There were several of these abrupt events that happened. First, there was an abrupt warm event known as the Bowling Alarod that happened about 14,500 years ago. And so there was a several degrees Celsius warming that happened quite quickly. And then just 1,000 years later, there was an abrupt cold event where it was a very quick return to Ice Age conditions. Glaciers started advancing again. Tundra reappeared in many places. And that would have happened, you know, again, within maybe a decade or less. And then the end of that event, about 1,000 years later, was also very abrupt. So within less than a century, several degrees Celsius warming, which is what we're looking at in the next century today. And so these kinds of very quick events were very shocking to scientists a few decades ago when we first discovered just how quickly the climate system could shift like that. Because the Earth's climate system is very complex. There are often lags in the system, especially because the oceans play such an important role, and the oceans tend to be very slow climate-wise. Because of the physics of water and how it works, it takes a lot of energy and a long time to sort of heat up or cool down, which is, as a side note, one of the reasons why if we were to shut down all greenhouse gas emissions now, we'd still be committed to a certain amount of warming just because the oceans still have to catch up. But even though we have these sort of slow processes in the climate system, there are things that can happen very abruptly, and that tends to involve the atmosphere and the way energy moves through the atmosphere, particularly with things like the jet stream. So one kind of small example that many of us would have been familiar with a couple winters ago was the polar vortex, right? This idea that you can have a stuck weather pattern with a lot of cold air kind of coming out of the Arctic and kind of creating an extreme event. And those kinds of events might be more common in the near future because of things like reducing the sea ice extent in the Arctic, right? So as we sort of move into a new regime in the climate system where we have less sea ice, we might start to see some of these kind of extreme events happening more. And so there's sort of short-term responses in the climate system as well as these sort of longer-term responses in the climate system. But those extreme events are often associated with changes in the atmosphere, which can happen very, very quickly. You know, we've all experienced those sudden events just even in terms of how we experience weather. Well, the same kinds of processes can play out as sort of longer-term trends in the climate.
Well, Jacqueline Gill, what is the BEAST Lab, and what does that acronym stand for?
Oh, good question. So we call our lab the BEAST Lab, where BEAST stands for Biodiversity and Environmental Change Across Space and Time. And so the space and time really reflects the fact that I am a paleoecologist, so we do a lot of research on changes through time, because I think time is a really important perspective if you want to understand environmental problems. And we also do a lot of research kind of zoomed out across space as well. And so if any of your listeners are Doctor Who fans, you know, a big contender was to be the TARDIS lab or the timey-wimey lab, but just this idea that we kind of are really taking a four-dimensional approach to environmental problem, because there's a lot that you can learn by taking change across space into account, so sort of a geographic perspective, as well as thinking about change through time. So we like a lot of kind of big picture thinking in this lab.
Well, I also ran into your blog called The Contemplative Mammoth, and you mentioned mammoths. I paid a visit. I was totally shocked to find that mammoths still lived when modern humans were farming. Is that possible?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, actually. And I like to call this idea of mammoth time, that for a lot of people, you know, you might have gotten one of those little plastic tubes of toys, you know, when you were a kid that had dinosaurs, and there may have been like some saber tooths and woolly mammoths thrown in together. You know, never mind that T-Rex and a mammoth were separated by 60 million years, 65 million years of time. But people just sort of think like it's a prehistoric creature, it's a fossil, you know, it's not relevant to my day-to-day life. And what's interesting is, if you realize just how recently mammoths were around, you I think might come to appreciate the role that they would have in our ecosystems a little bit better. And you know, most of the mammoths and other Ice Age animals were wiped out across the globe by, you know, 10 to 12,000 years ago. But there were a couple of populations of mammoths that held out until just a couple thousand years ago in some of the Arctic islands off of Siberia and Alaska. So Wrangel Island and St. Paul Island had these populations of woolly mammoths that persisted much, much longer. And in fact, would have been around during the time of the pyramids, during times when we had things like agriculture, writing, you know, number systems, even the wheel had been discovered at that point. And so I talked in my blog about how it would have been completely possible to have had a chariot drawn by a dwarf woolly mammoth if you had been able to put the two together at the right place, right? They were around at the same time, but they were just separated by a lot of geography. But if you think about that, you know, suddenly woolly mammoth time is much closer to our human civilization than people might normally think. And that, I think, allows you to start thinking about, okay, well, what are the impacts of the extinction of these Ice Age creatures? You know, what can we learn by studying the past, and how will that help us protect everything from elephants to Osage orange trees?
Okay, so what is a biogeographer?
A biogeographer is someone who studies basically where things live and why they don't live where they don't. And so really thinking about the distribution of where species are found and how that relates to climate, especially. But so thinking about the patterns of biodiversity on the Earth, like one classic problem in biogeography, for example, is why we tend to have more species closer to the equator than we have fewer as we go to the poles. And there are lots of kind of ecological puzzles like that. If you start to map out the distribution of life on Earth, you start to find some really interesting patterns that can really help you understand not only just individual species and their own unique needs, but also just how life works in general, and just having a really good grounding in, you know, the sort of mechanics of our ecosystems is, I think, crucial to being able to protect them.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
By the way, you are listening to Jacqueline Gill from the University of Maine. We are talking about the changing mosaic of living things and extinction in times of rapid warming. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. I'd like to get to what I see as kind of a founding paper. It was published in Conservation Biology in April 2015. The title is The Theory Behind and the Challenges of Conserving Nature's Stage in a Time of Rapid Change. The lead author is Joshua J. Lawler, with yourself as one of the co-authors. Jacqueline, what is that paper about? Why is it important?
That's a great question. So I talked earlier in the show about how we might need to start thinking outside the box in terms of conservation strategies. And there's a lot of interest in figuring out what the scale of conservation is. What's the grain size, so to speak? Are we going to try to keep focusing on individual species when those species themselves are moving around? Are we going to try to focus on conserving an entire ecosystem when we know that the components of that ecosystem are going to wink in and out as species track their individual climate needs and other environmental needs? And so what that does is it presents a really interesting challenge. And to really explain that challenge, I want to talk a little bit about the Endangered Species Act, which it turns out is not very robust when it comes to climate change. It's been the way here in the United States that we have been able to protect species that are at risk. And those individual species have to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and they have to have detailed recovery plans that are very specific to the biology of each of those organisms. And so what the Endangered Species Act does is it protects the place where the animal is found now. So let's say that there was, I don't know, a piping plover that I was really interested in protecting, or a species of bat, we'll say. And the place where that bird or bat is living now is protected under federal mandate, right? Well, what happens if the climate warms and that bird moves a couple hundred kilometers north to breed on a beach that's not protected? And there's not necessarily a quick response in terms of getting that new area protected for that bird. And meanwhile, the place that the bird has left is no longer going to be protected, which could have impacts to all kinds of other animals that may not necessarily have made it onto that Endangered Species Act yet. And so, you know, even just in terms of trying to protect the species that we have today under existing legislation, these regulations like the Endangered Species Act were not really designed for species that would be moving around because of climate change. And so this has gotten a lot of people thinking, like, well, what are the alternatives? If we don't focus on individual species, what should we be focusing on in terms of our conservation strategies? And there's this really interesting pattern, to go back to biogeography for a minute, which is that places that have a lot of geological diversity, so places with a lot of different rock types, a lot of landform types, different kinds of habitats that are, you know, very static, like cliffs, lots of geologic features, mountains, lots of interesting topography, those places tend to also have a lot of species. And that's an interesting pattern that people have started to identify. And so there's something inherent to having a lot of geodiversity that also tends to promote a lot of biodiversity. And there are a couple ideas about why that might be. There may be something just unique to having lots of habitat allows you to protect a lot of species. Maybe having lots of geological diversity means that you don't have a lot of human development, right? You know, there's a reason all of our, a lot of our national parks in the States tend to be in places that aren't really great for agriculture, for example, right? Places like Yosemite are very gorgeous, but for practical purposes, you know, weren't necessarily the first place people wanted to put farms and cities. It was just one reason that they ended up being protected, kind of in an unintentional way. So the idea in terms of what's known as conserving nature stage is the idea is if you think about the environment as the stage and species are the actors, instead of trying to protect or conserve the actors themselves, you just protect the stage. And the actors may come and go, and we might have to let go of some of our fixation on individual actors, but just be happy with the fact that we have a lot of biodiversity per se. And this is a pretty controversial idea, right? Because it might mean having to give up certain species that we care about and then trying to get people to care about something kind of abstract, which is just this idea of biodiversity. Having more species is good. We don't have to care necessarily about who those species are. But most people, you know, get into conservation because there are species or habitats that they really care about, right? I mean, people who are birders or, you know, other folks, botanists, people who are foragers, they get into conservation because they care about a particular environment or they care about a particular species. And so it's a really hard sell for a lot of people to get them to kind of give up on the idea of, you know, that piping plover or that bat that they really care about and just take consolation that over the long haul of climate change, and we're talking centuries to thousands of years or more, if we can protect these geodiverse regions, we will have more biodiversity protected. So it's like taking an umbrella approach that's based on the physical geography of a place rather than, you know, necessarily biodiversity hotspots per se.
I do find that a little unsettling because we've realized that we're entering perhaps the next sixth great mass extinction event. And you've talked about triage. And for listeners who aren't sure, triage in medical terms is when, for example, a hospital gets far too many people coming in with serious wounds or illnesses and they have to decide who gets treated first and perhaps who lives and who dies. Is that where we are now with other living things on this planet?
Oh, it's so hard to say. I mean, the reality is that we have very limited conservation dollars, and certainly in this country, the resources for science have been declining, even as the demand for those resources has increased. And I worry that, you know, if we don't start to prioritize, we will be bad at protecting the species that are most important, whether those are the ones that we care about or they provide some kind of important function on the landscape that we want to preserve or they're important for, you know, human health and livelihoods. And so I worry that we're approaching a tipping point in terms of our ability to keep a hold of the number of species that need to be protected, especially when you think about the fact that a lot of the Earth's biodiversity is concentrated in places that are the poorest. They have the fewest resources in terms of protecting species. So if we're having a hard time, you know, here in the United States managing the conservation of species with our existing infrastructure and regulations and NGOs and lots of, you know, local interest groups, you know, imagine being in a place where most of the biodiversity is. And a lot of those places are actively being deforested and converted into croplands or rangelands. And those countries don't necessarily, in the developing world, have the same kind of infrastructure to protect species. I mean, I hate to use the term triage because it means, you know, letting go of making conscious decisions about which species to let go. And by let go, I mean watch them go into extinction. And extinction, in theory, is forever, although as people are talking more about de-extinction and resurrecting species, maybe that's not necessarily true anymore. But I prefer to think about it in terms of prioritizing. So one of the reasons that I think looking at the paleo record is so valuable is that it allows me to focus my energies on protecting the species or the ecosystem processes that are going to be the most important. And so if there are some species that are really resilient to global change, we need to know who those are, right? So that we can divert attention away from them and onto the species that are the most vulnerable. And so rather than thinking about it in terms of triage, maybe a better way, at least for now, would be to think about it in terms of sort of a process of focusing our energy, not because everything else will go extinct, but to focus on the things that are most at risk, at least now. Because I think there are lots of stories of resilience. We often get caught up on the stories about risk, about species that are going extinct. But, you know, there are species that have made it through quite a lot of environmental changes. And so understanding which species those are or what it is about them or their communities that makes them more resilient is, I think, really important. In my work, I talk a lot about the extinction of Ice Age animals, things like mammoths and giant ground sloths and, you know, beaver the size of black bears. And we've lost those species forever, or at least until George Church's lab at Harvard brings the woolly mammoth back. But at the same time, if you look outside your window right now, every plant and animal that you see is an Ice Age survivor. And there's a tremendous amount of resilience that we don't pay nearly enough attention to, which isn't to say that we should just say, well, everything's going to be fine, but it allows us to focus that sort of limited energy and those limited resources on the most vulnerable species.
We've been told that if the temperature goes up 3 degrees C or more, the first to go would be the large mammals. And doesn't that describe humans as well?
Yeah, so humans are really interesting because we have a whole lot of behavioral adaptations that have made us incredibly resilient. We can modify our environment. We can utilize a really diverse array of, you know, foodstuffs, and those kinds of traits have made us super successful as a species. On the other hand, at a certain level, there are hard and fast limits in physiology that proteins denature at a certain temperature, right? You can only withstand temperatures that are so hot before, you know, you just can't anymore. And so big animals definitely can be at risk during warmer periods. But one benefit that big animals tend to have is that they can move around relative to smaller animals. They can kind of get to the places that they need to get to. That's harder if the place you need to get to is paved over or there's no corridor to get there, which is why, you know, protecting large swaths of land is really important if we want to protect our biggest animals. So that's definitely a concern. But there are still also some behavioral adaptations to kind of persisting in place, whether that's changing the time of day that you're active or, you know, using water more or mud or other kinds of physical activities to kind of modify your immediate microclimate. And a lot of animals have figured out strategies like that, but they're really only good in the short term. We have to make sure that we have places for these big animals to go, because we know from, you know, research that's been done in my lab and by other folks that these really large animals tend to have really disproportionate impact on their environments, and that when we lose them, we might actually be making their habitats less resilient to climate change. There's some really cool work that's been done in Greenland looking at grasslands that have had herbivores kept out and then have allowed herbivores in. And what they found is that over, I think it was like a 15-year or period of warming, and this was some work by Eric Post, where they had a grazing exposure and they kept animals out from this grassland. And the grassland that warmed up with animals was much more resilient than the grassland that warmed up but where the animals were kept out. So it was kind of a convoluted way of saying big animals may actually help buffer the impact of climate change on plants. And some of the work that I've done in my lab on Ice Age herbivores and their extinction also supports this idea that large herbivores are somehow buffering the impacts of climate change on vegetation. And that, you know, again, shows that there are certain animals that maybe we should be focusing our efforts and attention on. Which is funny, too, because, you know, so many people have been saying, oh, it's always the charismatic megafauna. We need to stop worrying about, you know, these. We pay all our attention on these really big, attractive animals. And then meanwhile, the little, you know, slugs and fungi and other things that are important don't get any attention. But it may turn out that the charismatic megafauna have such a big impact on their environments that they deserve some attention, at least.
Well, we're starting to wrap up, but researching your work, I kept finding the phrase no analog future. What does that mean, and why is it so disturbing to natural scientists?
Oh, it's a good question. So when we look at the past, we have identified periods following the end of the last ice age where the climates and also the ecological communities, the forest types, have no modern analog. So they're really novel in terms of anything we see on the landscape today. And we know that when climates are novel, so novel combinations of temperature and precipitation that we just don't find on the landscape anywhere on the planet now, when the climates were novel in the past, the ecosystems responded in unpredictable ways, right? Sort of going into a no man's land or an uncharted territory, I guess, like here be dragons, right? And we know that those kinds of climate changes are happening now. Their novel climates are emerging, you know, now and in the next century. In many cases, because we're making warm places warmer than we have anywhere on the planet, we're changing combinations of temperature and precipitation. So the tropics, for example, may be especially at risk of these emerging new climates, and we may be losing other combinations of climate. And that's going to matter to species who need those combinations of climates, right? If you can only live within a certain range of temperature or precipitation conditions. But the other thing I think that is the important take home is that where we don't have an analog, it becomes really difficult to make a prediction. So protecting species in this sort of no man's land of knowledge becomes incredibly challenging for especially people really on the front lines, the people who are managing reserves, or if you have a particular, you know, conservation easement or something that you need to take care of.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. We have been talking with Dr. Jacqueline Gill. She's a kind of time hunter, although that's officially called a paleoecologist and a biogeographer. Jacqueline is an assistant professor at the University of Maine School of Biology, Ecology, and the Climate Change Institute. She's active in the research community and publishes scientific papers, which I think are on the leading edge. I'll put links to those and to Jacqueline's Woolly Mammoth blog in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Jacqueline, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Oh, heavenly grid, help us spare up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking. Here in this shell, we call life.
It sounds like our best scientists will need outlets like Radio EcoShock even more than ever. According to an article at Politico.com published December 9th, quote, Donald Trump's transition team wants the Energy Department to provide the names of any employees who have worked on President Barack Obama's climate initiatives, a request that has current and former staffers fearing an oncoming witch hunt. End quote. That's on top of the Trump team's threats to cut $2 billion in climate research at NASA. Welcome to the new dark age, where the religion of money trumps reality. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, where I'll continue to pump out climate science direct from the source as long as my brain and breath continue. I'm Alex Smith. Please tell your friends and anyone who will listen about this program. And please join us again next week for more. You've heard bits from my new Radio EcoShock song. It's called Future EcoShock. Find the whole thing to listen, download, or share at soundcloud.com or at my own website, ecoshock.org. Here it is, Future EcoShock.
Once you know the future, look out for it. We all have them. We all have. Know the future. We all have them. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We're joined today by Mariam Griffin, co-editor with William Robinson of the new book, We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics, out now from AK Press. The book is a collection of essays and testimonials from scholars, students, and organizers who are on the front lines in the fight against growing repression and the silencing of Palestine advocacy on campuses across the U.S. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says that the book is, quote, a stunning portrait of the extent to which the forces that suppress free speech are at work in the U.S. university system. Mariam Griffin, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Nora.
So first off, talk a little bit about your background. You're a postdoctoral fellow at UC Davis, a campus in the University of California system that has seen its share of repression of students and members of faculty who criticize Israel. Can you talk about your experiences in academia thus far and what led you to co-edit this volume of others' experiences?
Absolutely. So I have been in the UC for a very long time. I did my undergraduate work and my I went to law school at UCLA. And then I was at UC Santa Barbara for my PhD. And now I've just completed 2 years as a postdoc at UC Davis. And one thing that having been at all of these UC campuses has done is it has exposed me to different perspectives of how these forces of repression, particularly as they target, any kind of activism that is in any way critical of Israel or even activism that recognizes the humanity of Palestinians at base, gets targeted. And, it could be timing. I don't want to attribute it all to campuses, but in my opinion, UCLA is an epicenter for a lot of these attacks. And while I was at UCLA as an undergrad, there was some physical attacks against pro-Palestinian activists at the time. There was just a ton of pressure against the Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. It has gone through a lot of different phases, but one of the things that students have to do sometimes because of this pressure is that they subsume their SJP chapters into other groups, like the Muslim Students Association, I believe, was the student organization that absorbed SJP for a time when I was an undergrad, and that kind of thing. So, you know, there's really just all kinds of pressure that's exerted against students, against faculty, and against everyone in between. And so we have to come up with different ways of responding to that. When I was in law school, we decided that we were going to start a chapter called the Law Students for Justice in Palestine. And, anytime we would have an event, people would come and take pictures of the participants. They would ask, disruptive questions to panelists that force them to basically disavow terrorism, even if the event had nothing to do with terrorism. So it was this I would call it overtly racist association with anything that recognizes anyone whose perspective comes from a place of recognizing Palestinian humanity with the perspective of being pro-terrorism. And just that kind of thing. We had that a lot at UCLA, but we saw similar kinds of tactics at UC Santa Barbara. And it was at UC Santa Barbara where I met my co-editor, who was at the time a professor in my department. And in my first year, I started grad school in 2008 to 2009. And that was, the December to January period when Israel launched its siege, one of its many sieges on Gaza. And they call it Operation Cast Lead. And, I was very upset at the time, expressing myself on the internet, expressing myself in real life. And because of some of that expression on the internet, an acquaintance of mine went and contacted my department and urged that they kick me out of the department and alleged that I was engaged in racist and anti-Semitic speech because all I was doing was actually just sharing journal articles about the attack and captioning them with my rage. And so, you know, I was called into the office and happily I was in a department that was, you know, very supportive, and they recognized that this was just basically racism, like, you know, seeing an Arab American express their opinions and outrage against the killing of the mass killing of Palestinians was just, you know, calling that racism is just itself a form of racism. But, you know, it could have turned out differently if I was at a different department. And so that was sort of jarring for me. And then right after that, William Robinson, my co-editor, experienced something on a much bigger scale that he writes about in this book. And that is that basically he shared some material with his students about Operation Cast Lead. And a number of off-campus Zionist organizations then mounted a very strong pressure campaign targeting the administration on campus to basically get him censured and or fired. And that caused him to lose many months of sleep. You know, it caused him a lot of stress, and it caused damage to his international reputation. And, you know, happily, He has allies all over the world that rallied to his cause, and also happily we were able to defeat those efforts. But, you know, they cost. They have a cost. And so, you know, I'm sorry, my answer is very long in response to your short question. But the point is that we really wanted to provide a compendium of just a few stories told by the people who actually experience them that highlight the many different ways that the many different strategies that are deployed by these Zionist organizations to silence people who share these perspectives. And again, the perspectives range from bare recognition of Palestinian humanity all the way to a strong critique of Israeli policies. And also, you know, the costs, to highlight the costs that those strategies then wreak on people's lives, that also range from things like people losing their jobs or losing their tenure battles, all the way to, you know, smaller scale things that still matter. You know, the personal stress that this causes, the personal relationships that it costs, the business relationships that it costs for some people. David Delgado Shorter writes about that in his chapter. And so I think, you know, these are important details that get missed in some of the coverage of these different attacks. The other thing that I felt was very important to highlight was that people who experience these attacks don't just roll over and give in. And so we wanted to make sure that all of the voices in the volume, you know, just report on the different strategies that they use to resist the pressure to be silent, and also how we as a community tend to band together to really resist those efforts, because this is not a battle that we can win one by one. It's a battle that requires that we are always working together in community.
Mariam Griffin, you mentioned the price that people pay for speaking out, and I'm thinking of some of the contributors to this the extraordinary volume of essays. Joseph Massad, who's been battling repression at Columbia University for years and years. Rabab Abdulhadi of the San Francisco State University, who has been the target of a right-wing silencing campaign. Steve Saleta, of course, who just recently wrapped up teaching at the American University of Beirut and cannot find a teaching position here in the U.S. due to his blacklisting, essentially, for speaking out against Israel's crimes against Palestinians. And two members of the Irvine 11, Taher Herzela and Osama Shabake, who were students from UC Irvine and UC Riverside, who protested a speech by then Israel Ambassador Michael Oren in 2010, and were then investigated for a year by the county's district attorney's office, and then ultimately found guilty of conspiracy to disrupt the speech. We covered that story as it was happening, of course, but obviously that story became an allegory of sorts in terms of how far local governments and the Israel lobby were willing to go to prosecute Palestine rights advocates. But how, as you pointed out, this and as the students say themselves, through that trial, their voices only became more amplified. Can you talk about that essay by Tahir and Osama and why you felt it was important to talk about the Irvine 11 case in the book?
Absolutely. There were a number of reasons why I thought it was important. One is what you pointed out about the absolutely desperate lengths that people in power are willing to go to silence that the perspective of people who are, critical of the state of Israel. The other reason is to make sure that we had some student voices, because it's our opinion that it's a fact that these organizations target the university as a whole, as a space. And so basically anyone involved in the space is vulnerable to these attacks, whether they are students who come and then go after a certain number of years, and are threatened, personally with violence and death threats, are threatened by police visiting them, which happened at Davis, which happened at Santa Barbara, whether they're threatened with future work prospects by being placed on these public blacklists, et cetera. And so that's the kind of thing that I thought was very important to include alongside the essays by graduate students, by lecturers, and by tenured or tenure-seeking faculty. But to get back to the first point that you raised about the really desperate lengths that people in power will go, I think the word allegory is a great descriptor for that story, because we see now that this trend is just getting stronger. And so the forces of repression, or the forces of silencing that target people critical of the state of Israel, are turning their sights less toward shoring up, popular opinion, and more toward shoring up the favor of people in power who are going to use repressive or tyrannical tactics backed by state power in one way or another to silence people, because they seem to have lost or are losing the public opinion campaign. And so I know that the Electronic Intifada has reported on this, but not too many other news outlets are reporting on this new bill that has been proposed in Congress, in both houses of Congress, in March, that seeks to criminalize any kind of support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against the state of Israel. And now, of course, BDS is one of the very famous, nonviolent international civil society movements that is all about people using the everyday small decisions that they have the power to make to collectively send pressure to an otherwise seemingly extremely powerful government. And so instead of listening to their constituents, the U.S. government has decided to try to silence and criminalize that kind of expression. In any case, I bring it up, I'm sorry, it's a bit off topic, but I'm trying to put it in conversation with what happened to the Irvine 11. Imagine students who are engaged in routine student protest on their campus, to which they pay exorbitant fees to attend, and are not only censured by their university for engaging in what is ultimately protected political speech, or should be anyway in this country, but also then have charges brought against them by the district attorney. So, these are, when we're talking about the spectrum of strategies that are used, I think it's really important to focus on where the pressure is coming from. Because again, as I said at the beginning, I think this really signals the fact that these organizations that are part of the Israel on Campus Coalition and others are feeling that public opinion, international public opinion, and public opinion in the U.S. is starting to turn against Israel's crimes. And that is very alarming. And so instead of, and knowing that they are losing that battle, they have taken to these very directly repressive channels instead.
That's the voice of Mariam Griffin. She is the co-editor with William Robinson of a new book called We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics, published by AK Press. Finally, Mariam, let's talk about Stephen Saleta and his essay in the book. Actually, I want to read the last two paragraphs of his essay before we talk about it, because I think they distill everything into two paragraphs. He says, "I believe deeply in the idea of education for improvement, not merely economic improvement, but psychological, intellectual, spiritual, and ethical as well. We cannot undertake this task in environments in which unpopular or unorthodox ideas are banished. The basic goal of a critical education is to vitiate the sacrosanct and demythologize the consecrated. We do this by fighting. No theory is worth anything if it doesn't put us in a better position to eradicate justice. No pedagogy is worth employing if it doesn't help students understand the transformative potential of theory. Insofar as the corporate university treats justice as a threat to brand equity, we must then seek the eradication of the corporate university." Tell us about Stephen Saleta's case, what he talks about in his essay, and what his story tells us in terms of the state of academia and academic freedom when it comes to criticizing Israel.
Yes, so this is a very dark story in a lot of ways. And the chapter from Stephen Saleta is a little bit different than the rest of the chapters, and it's why we chose to finish with it. Stephen offers a critique of what is happening in academia as a whole. He connects that to, the rise of corporatism, the rise of transnational capital as a priority in the U.S. university, and also to settler colonialism. And I think that those intertwined stories are essential for understanding really the stakes of this fight. They're stakes that should concern people, everyone, not just those who take a particular interest in Palestine and that story. And so what happened to Stephen Saleta is that he was offered and accepted a job at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a tenure job. And he went there, he moved there. You know, this is a very typical way of getting jobs in academia. You know, you're offered and you accepted, you move to the place and you start your job. And basically, during that time, during that summer, Israel was committing another siege against Gaza and was extremely savage. And Steve went to Twitter and tweeted some of his thoughts about that. And those thoughts were deemed unacceptable to, among Zionists in the U.S. And so they mounted a campaign, as they do, with, you know, as they've done with all of the contributors and with many, many other people who have any kind of audience, basically, to criticize Israel in front of. And they pressured the university, and they used financial pressures and threats to the university. And so the university backed out of their agreement with Steve and effectively fired him. At the end of the day, it went to court and all of that. There was a settlement in favor of Steve. He got a little bit of recognition of wrongdoing, but not nearly enough. And the cost of losing that job was just a fraction of the cost that he ultimately has had to pay for opposing the mass murder of Palestinians in Gaza. The cost, as you mentioned, was a blacklisting. He recently published a piece, I guess it started as a Facebook post, you know, reflecting a little bit on being constructively kicked out of academia for holding these political opinions which are just like a human reaction to the facts. You know, it's like, I don't accept mass murder. And for taking that position, you know, he has not only not been able to find jobs at various kinds of campuses and institutions, but also when, you know, his close colleagues, his collaborators, people who know his illustrious, you know, body of work, which is just amazing for any academic, let alone one who's faced so much criticism. They try to arrange positions for him of various kinds, and the administration shuts them down. And, you know, these are ultimately decisions that could be characterized as, oh, they're financial decisions, or they're, you know, risk averse decisions, or whatever it is. We have examples of universities that make risky decisions and stick with them. So there are, you know, on other topics, universities are available to make principled decisions rather than profit-driven decisions. But nonetheless, let's take them on their word. I think that that by itself is an indictment of what's happening in academia, that across the board, institutions are making decisions that are hostile to academic freedom, and they're hostile to the free and fair exchange of ideas, and instead are thinking more about profit making and thinking more about, you know, just money. Let's put it that way. Again, I'm saying that taking them at their word. I personally think that a lot of these decisions are ideologically motivated, but even if they weren't, the idea that the university is just blacklisting people who might cost them a little bit of money should worry everyone who holds an opinion that's critical of mainstream beliefs.
What do you hope that readers get out of this book? What are you hoping is the overarching theme that people can connect with?
You know, Nora, there was a fear that I had that might be reinforced by the stories that we did choose to talk about today, which is that this book does the work of Zionist organizations by, you know, fear mongering, or by presenting all of these scary stories of what can happen to people if they speak out. But my, Williams and my, motivation in the first place for writing this book was quite the opposite, was to shine a light on the strategies that are deployed in secret. Most of these campaigns happen anonymously, or they happen behind closed doors. They happen with phone calls to administrators and to, you know, secret meetings, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not being a conspiracy theorist. We have this book presents the data of exactly how those things happen. And so we wanted to shine a light on those things so that they lose the protection of secrecy, and also to show people that even when Israel's critics pay the ultimate price, like Steve did, and I never want to in any way diminish that price, because he really has paid such a great price. Here he is. He's still speaking his mind. He's still standing his ground, because ultimately that is we who take this position have the moral authority and feel that our position is about justice and about humanity. But, you know, taking this position that is, again, inflected by a commitment toward justice, you can't compromise that. There's nothing that's worth compromising that at the end of the day. And I think all of the contributors and all of the people who are critical of Israel, who fight this fight on a daily basis, know that whatever price we pay here is nothing compared to the price that Palestinians are paying every day. I mean, here's Gaza sitting in the dark for 22 hours a day right now. That is just so much more urgent and important than the kinds of concerns that we may face if we are targeted with repression. And so I hope that people who read this book, who peruse the firsthand testimonies, the personal stories of these contributors, not only learn about, you know, the strategies that Zionist organizations use, and read between the lines about what that means about them losing power in the realm of public opinion, but also read these stories as stories of hope and stories that testify to the vast international network of allies of Palestinians, of supporters, of those who are willing to make sacrifices to ensure that one day Palestine will be free.
Mariam Griffin, you are the co-editor of We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Cushman, managing editor with Inside Climate News, who examines the links between climate change and extreme weather patterns that brought devastating floods to southeast Texas. Beau Webb of the group Coal River Mountain Watch, who responds to the Trump administration's suspension of funds needed to complete research on the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining. And Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the balance between corporate and public interest as the Trump administration renegotiates the North American Free Trade Agreement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Women's advocates in South Asia won a historic victory when India's Supreme Court ruled the instant Islamic divorce was unconstitutional. India is one of the few nations where Muslim men can get a divorce by simply saying the word talaq, or divorce, in Arabic three times. The Indian High Court ruled in favor of a petition filed by five Muslim women who were subject to the Islamic quick divorce against their will. India has become the 23rd country to outlaw talaq divorce, joining nations including Egypt, Sri Lanka, the United Arab Emirates, Malaysia, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. The Islamic quick divorce, however, continues to be practiced in ultra-conservative Saudi Arabia. Human rights advocates say poor women are the primary victims of the talaq divorce, which often leaves them without any right to alimony and destitute with nowhere to live. Many Muslim women who are forced into quick divorces now say they'll use India's progressive civil divorce laws that entitle a wife to one-third of her husband's salary in order to pay for child support and living expenses. Bronx fast food worker Flavio Cabral, who joined the Fight for $15 minimum wage movement 4 years ago, has seen her hourly wage at McDonald's rise to $12 an hour. Still, her dream of being able to afford to pay for her daughter's college education is still a distant goal. Fight for 15 and its allies succeeded in pressuring New York State to commit to a $15 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers. But most fast food employees work part-time and lack union workplace protections. These workers won a significant victory when the New York City Council passed a series of reforms that mandate predictable schedules and requires restaurants to offer extra hours to current workers before they hire new employees. Similar laws have been passed in Seattle and San Francisco. New York City's reforms also allow fast food workers to join a new form of labor organization, which will advocate for workers throughout the industry and sustain itself through dues deducted voluntarily from workers' paychecks. Some labor observers say this model could help launch a sector-wide fast food union, a longtime goal of the U.S. labor movement. But according to the magazine In These Times, major barriers to organizing fast food workers remain, including the rapid turnover of these low-paid employees who work directly for franchises, not the giant chains like McDonald's. America took notice last May when three white men on a light rail transit line in Portland, Oregon, bravely intervened to protect two minority women being harassed by a white nationalist. The harasser, Jeremy Christian, stabbed two of the men to death. While Portland has a reputation for being a liberal, inclusive bastion of diversity, the reality of race relations in the city tells a different story. For years, African Americans have left major cities like San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland for the suburbs. Today, blacks only make up 3% of Oregon's population, far below the national average. Traditional black neighborhoods in Portland have been gentrified and are quickly disappearing. Census numbers show 10,000 African Americans moved out of the city center between 2000 and 2010. Blacks in the City of Roses only make an average income of $30,000 a year. Meanwhile, black teenagers are in juvenile detention at five times the rate of white youths. Ellis Ray Leary, a black Portland resident, observed, "What bubbles up is this thing with a progressive veneer that covers a sinister underbelly. The question now is, how does that translate into a positive regard for black people going forward, and what is the impact of that on white liberal cities in America?" This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As large sections of Houston, America's fourth largest city, was inundated with floodwaters, driving tens of thousands of residents from their homes, the nation received yet another wake-up call regarding the increasing frequency of extreme weather events that have triggered a series of recent historic natural disasters. Since Hurricane Harvey struck the Texas coast on August 25th, parts of Houston have seen a record 50 inches of rainfall, more than the city usually receives in a year. The death toll stood at 11 on August 29th, but officials feared that number would likely rise. Federal agencies estimated that as many as 30,000 people have been forced to leave their homes for shelters, and more than 450,000 people are likely to seek federal aid. As the online publication Inside Climate News observed, the immediate priorities, rescue operations, disaster assistance, flood insurance, and the like, will be followed by broader questions involving the vulnerability of infrastructure, the energy industry, and communities to extreme weather, and the need to balance mitigation of the pollution that causes climate change with adaptation to global warming's inescapable impacts. Your reporter spoke with John H. Cushman, Jr., managing editor of Inside Climate News, who examines the links between climate change and extreme weather patterns that brought devastating floods to southeast Texas, and the disconnect between public opinion that increasingly recognizes the destructive consequences of global warming and conservative politicians who continue to dismiss climate change as a hoax.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the consensus among scientists who study this closely is that we're seeing increasingly clearly the manifestations of a climate change that has been brought on by man-made pollution, principally of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels, although there are other sources of global warming pollution as well. And when I say that we're seeing the manifestations of it, of course, there have been hurricanes for a long, long time. But scientists began to recognize 30 or 40 years ago with increasing certainty over the past decades that the blanket of carbon dioxide that we were surrounding our planet with was going to cause profound warming, and that we understood the physics of this, and scientists began to examine more and more closely what the symptoms would be. And among the symptoms of a warming atmosphere would be more intense rainfalls in the largest storms. Among the symptoms of warming ocean waters would be intensification of some hurricanes. Among the symptoms of global warming would be the melting of the world's ice, which would lead to sea level rise. And, of course, sea level rise would also be exacerbated by the warming of the oceans. And so when you combine these things together, what you see is an increasing risk that any particular storm will produce extreme results. In other words, the dice were being loaded for the kind of event that we're seeing today. And that's different than saying climate change caused this hurricane to happen, but this hurricane's characteristics are quite consistent with what the models have forecast for a long time. And it's pretty discouraging to see that, during our lifetimes, we began to understand this, and yet we're so far from the solutions that are needed to head off even more extreme events in our children's and grandchildren's generations.
John Cushman, one of the sad ironies here is that the fossil fuel industry centered around Houston, one of the largest concentration of oil refineries in the country, is really the engine of economic growth in the Houston area and in Texas. And this is the area, of course, that's now being devastated with the extreme rainfall that we're seeing as a result of Hurricane Harvey. What can you say about what's happening there to that particular region? How much of an impact do you think that has on folks who've benefited from the economic boom that's taken place in that part of the country?
Right, and to a considerable degree, all of us have benefited from the fossil fuel era when it was in full swing. And, of course, the development of the United States as the world's preeminent economy was largely related to the rise of this industry. The problem is that in developing the riches of fossil fuels, we had a mindset that the energy would be cheap, but that the pollution would be free, by which I mean that nobody was paying for the externalities, the costs that are associated with this carbon dioxide pollution. And until we recognized the costs of climate change and incorporated into the market price of fossil fuels, we are not going to be able to steer ourselves successfully to alternative fuels. And the time for alternative fuels has now arrived.
John Cushman, with a greater frequency of these extreme weather crises and the hundreds of billions of dollars that are being allocated to help people in need and have lost their homes, their cars, what they depend on for everyday life, public opinion seems to be moving in the direction to rejecting the climate change denial that we see in the Trump administration, among the cabinet officials, and of course President Trump himself, who just withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Where do you see public opinion in the United States headed, given the frequency of these extreme weather situations? And what effect is that going to have on U.S. politics, where we have one particular political party, the Republicans, who champion climate change denial?
Well, you're asking me questions of which I have very little expertise or proficiency. But in this arena, I have seen, and dating back for decades as a journalist, a persistent and dedicated attempt by many different actors to confuse the public. I found myself rereading articles that I'd written in the 1990s when I was covering the environment beat in Washington, in which the petroleum industry was setting about to form committees who would make the public believe that there was too much uncertainty in the science of climate change to be able to base any policy decisions on the science as it then existed, when in fact the science had long progressed to the point, and it has continued to progress farther and farther in the direction of guiding policymakers about how to deal with these risks. And they are risks, and there are uncertainties, but it's very important not to allow uncertainty to become an excuse for inaction. That isn't where the science points us.
That was John H. Cushman, Jr., managing editor of Inside Climate News. Learn more about the links between the greater frequency of extreme weather patterns around the world and climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For years, medical research in communities near mountaintop removal coal mining sites, or MTR, has revealed higher incidences of birth defects, cancer, and early mortality than in control communities. Mountaintop removal mining blasts the tops off mountain ridges with dynamite, contaminating the air and impacting water quality. After years of grassroots organizing against MTR in southern West Virginia, the State Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Health requested help from the Federal Office of Surface Mining to review health studies. In the waning days of the Obama administration, the office, which is part of the Interior Department, allocated $1 million for the review. However, on August 20th, the Trump administration's Interior Department halted the study in order to review all grants over $100,000. The organization leading the study, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, confirmed the Interior Department order and wrote, "The National Academies believe this is an important study, and we stand ready to resume it as soon as the Department of the Interior review is completed." National environmental groups condemned the decision. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bo Webb, a former board president and current member of the group Coal River Mountain Watch, who lived in the heart of the coal fields for many years and is now a leader of the effort to pressure the government to research the health impacts of MTR. For the past several years, he's advocated congressional adoption of the AIC Act, standing for the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, which would require a halt to mountaintop removal coal mining until studies can prove it's safe, something he's confident could never be substantiated. Webb organized a protest in 2015 to push for the legislation and picks up the story from there.
The head of West Virginia's Department of Health, we met with him 2 weeks, maybe 10 days later, and then he said that, you know, West Virginia didn't have the resources, the money, nor the people to really do such a review of all this research. So he contacted the Federal Office of Surface Mining at Interior, and then Joe Pisarcik, who we had dealt with before, head of OSM, he went to the National Academy of Sciences and brought them in to do the review. And what National Academy of Sciences was doing here was a review of all of the existing research. That's all it was. It wasn't anything new. Then that was going to take them 2 years to do it. It was going to cost $1 million. They put together a team. They brought in scientists, independent scientists. They also brought in some ex-coal people that were scientists. And they promised they would hold public hearings, and they have been doing that, giving us up to date. And then when they would have testimony from a scientist, they did it in Charleston. They just last week did it in Kentucky. They were in the middle of reviewing all of the research, and then Trump just put the kibosh on it and shut it down. So we know that people are getting sick and dying. And so the Trump administration basically has just decided to ignore all of that. And regardless of what the research has said, regardless of what people that live there witnessing this say, it doesn't matter. He's basically given the green light to the coal industry to blow the mountains up, and if you kill the residents nearby, it's okay. That's really the bottom line. This review thing could cause us some problems, so let's just don't do it. Let's just stop it.
So, Bo Webb, what do you think is the next step? Do you think you can get the funding restored?
Well, that's what I'm trying to work on now, and I'm hoping to go down to D.C. in a couple of weeks here and meet with Senator Sanders' office. I spoke with him, but most of them are out on vacation. So I want to go down and talk with them and try to get some pressure applied in Congress and the Senate to get that. A million bucks is a drop in the bucket. Plus, they're probably 30% into the work already. All indications are the air that people are breathing in those communities is toxic and contaminated. You know, in the United States Geological Survey identified what's in the dust, and it boils down to silica, aluminum, and molybdenum, which is a metal. And the USGS, what they did, they showed this coming from the mountaintop removal sites. They showed it in the amount of dust they were collecting. When the mines were very active, there were huger amounts of silica and aluminum in the air in fine particulates, which enters your lungs. You don't have any defense against it. And we know physical lab work that it's causing the growth of tumors in human lungs. And it's still going on.
You have been promoting the AIC Act, which stands for Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, since 2012, but it hasn't caught fire yet in Congress. Do you think the publicity surrounding the cancellation or postponement or whatever it is of this study could jumpstart support for the bill?
Well, it will if we, and I, when I say we, I'm talking about myself and the people I work with and nonprofits all over, jump on this. If we remain silent, if people aren't working on it, it'll just die. It'll just disappear and go away. We need to do a lot of things. We need to get to D.C. and expose this and really harp on this and get this continued and bring about more awareness and hopefully just say, you know what, we just need to stop mountaintop removal right now today.
That was Bo Webb, a former board president and current member of the group Coal River Mountain Watch. Learn more about research into the health effects of mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a contentious national debate, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, came into force on January 1, 1994. The trade treaty between the United States, Canada, and Mexico granted new powers and privileges to multinational corporations. Key provisions in NAFTA made it easier for U.S.-based corporations to outsource jobs to cheap labor markets overseas, where governments don't protect workers' rights. NAFTA also permits corporations to challenge government regulations that protect public health, consumer safety, and the environment, and launch lawsuits to recover lost profits. Economic studies conclude that NAFTA cost hundreds of thousands of good-paying U.S. manufacturing jobs and played an important role in decimating America's middle class. During the 2016 presidential campaign, candidate Donald Trump, in contrast to the pro-free trade Republican Party, denounced NAFTA and pledged that if elected, he would either scrap or renegotiate NAFTA. After 7 months in office, the Trump administration recently completed a first round of talks to renegotiate the terms of NAFTA and is scheduled to begin a second round September 1st in Mexico City. In his speeches, Trump regularly threatens to withdraw from NAFTA if Canada and Mexico refuse to sign on to provisions that would bring back American manufacturing jobs. Your reporter spoke with Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses what must be changed in NAFTA to restore the balance between corporate and public interest and expresses doubts that the Trump agenda on transforming the treaty will benefit American workers.
Progressives like us and the labor and environmental community have been very critical of NAFTA since the beginning, and we have been very clear that we have a list of demands of things that must come out such as these investor protections that incentivize job offshoring and what must go in, which is strong and enforceable labor and environmental and human rights protections that has not been a part of it, and a whole host of other things. Now, Donald Trump has also said that NAFTA was a disaster, but, you know, he talks about this in terms of America first, you know, has scapegoated Mexicans in a whole host of areas, has talks about building a wall, and also in the context of this, and so this is antithetical to the progressive vision of this. You know, he has stated that his goal is to reduce the trade deficit, which is important in terms of helping to create jobs in the United States, particularly manufacturing and other jobs that have been hollowed out in the NAFTA era. But unfortunately, what we've seen so far is the same closed process. We have not seen, you know, the texts that they're planning to put forward. The same closed process with 500 corporate advisors is intact while the public is being locked out. And so what's really important now is to call out in whose interest is this renegotiation going to happen. We have been calling for NAFTA to be replaced since the beginning. But at this point, it's really important to look at the process and to make clear what the demands are, that a tweak of NAFTA is not going to cut it in any way, that the devastation that NAFTA has wrought in terms of incentivizing offshorers, we've seen more than 900,000 jobs have been officially certified by the Department of Labor as being lost to NAFTA, and we know that's a severe undercount because it's a very narrow program. And then at the same time, there have been these provisions that allow multinational corporations to attack public health, safety, environmental safeguards, and we've seen nearly $400 million of taxpayer money has been paid to corporations by these tribunals already under NAFTA. So those are the things that we need to watch to see, are they going to eliminate these provisions that incentivize jobs offshoring and allow corporations to attack our laws? Are they going to eliminate the provisions that undermine our Buy American and Buy Local policies that are in NAFTA? Are they going to eliminate the provisions that push this deregulatory agenda so we can't regulate Wall Street and we can't regulate our food imports, et cetera? And then will there really be the types of policies and strong standards in environment and labor that lift up standards in all three countries instead of encouraging this race to the bottom that we have seen, particularly in Mexico?
Melinda, during the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, a very powerful coalition emerged made up of civil society groups, labor, environmental, human rights organizations, all coming out in opposition to President Obama's pushing the TPP. What's the coalition look like now that is pressuring the Trump administration and Congress to ensure the pro-worker planks are part of the NAFTA renegotiation here?
Well, you're right that there was an unprecedented coalition opposing the TPP that was large in both its numbers and breadth of different sectors, and that coalition has pivoted to NAFTA. Now, I will say that in the Trump era, many of the organizations, like the environmental organizations, the labor organizations, human rights groups, and immigrants' rights groups are under attack in a whole host of areas. I mean, that is a real problem because everyone's having to fight on multiple fronts. But I will say that same coalition, there's the Citizens Trade Campaign that brings together family, farm, environment, labor, faith groups, consumer groups, that coalition is mobilizing. There's much more to do to counter this narrative that unfortunately has been pushed in this era, which is either you are for free trade or you're a protectionist. And what we need to be clear about is who have been the winners and who are writing the rules and for whom. And we need to make sure that it's the public is centered there and not just big corporations.
That was Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Learn more about the Progressive Coalition campaigning to replace NAFTA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The politics of fear. As I said previously, the recent events of Charlottesville, Virginia, were turning points in American history. But what is its source? Its source is the source of American identity. For what makes America, America, is not what it is, but what it is not. An African historian once told me that American identity was formed negatively. He explained that America was formed by populations that defined itself as white. What did white mean? It meant non-black, non-Indian, non-Asian, and non-Latinos. That was its beginnings. That is its present. Donald Trump ran on fear, white fear. Fear of blacks, foreigners, everybody else. And Charlottesville, Virginia is a reflection, too, of that white fear. America is a land awash in fear. Fear of the future. Fear of a black and brown planet. Fear of the passing away of white America. Fear of the America to come. That fear made Trump president. That fear lies beneath everything. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Storms over Texas. Hurricane Harvey has struck the Gulf region of Texas, and it has hit with an awe and power that can scarcely be believed. Houston, which took the title to the fourth largest city in America from Philadelphia years ago, now has a new title, Most Flooded U.S. City in U.S. History. Harvey became a tropical storm, spun back into the Gulf, and returned with a vengeance, spilling over 50 inches of rain in hours, sending most of the city into floods that Americans haven't seen since Katrina in New Orleans. It arrives just in time to remind people what global warming means, even as its idiotic misleader claims climate change is a hoax. President Trump, called by some insane clown president, once called climate change just that, as he arrives for a photo op. Is it a hoax now? Thousands of people are watching their lives wash away with higher and higher floodwaters. Politicians, whores of their corporate funders, are smiling as they bank their donations, while mothers and grandmothers and children drown in their attics and in flood-swollen streets in America's fourth largest city. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have another packed show for you today. It's a very serious show, and it's one that I'm really looking forward to bringing to you.
At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with a man named David Freeman, and we're going to be talking with him about Charlottesville and why there are only two sides in this fight. Okay, and that's actually something he's made some pretty important points out in light of the kind of what broke out in Charlottesville. All right, and it's a very important conversation we'll be having.
Before that, we'll be hearing an interview I did with Matt Ruskin, the writer and director of a new feature film, Crown Heights, which is in theaters all over the U.S. right now. It tells the story of Colin Warner, a young black man framed by police for murder and locked up for more than 20 years. And it also tells of the struggle of his best friend and others on the outside to gain his freedom. And it is also the story of the system that has carried out the mass incarceration of black and brown people, a slow genocide backed up and intensified by the highest levels of this system.
But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show
Trevor Timm. Trevor Timm is a co-founder and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He is a journalist, activist, and lawyer who writes a weekly column for The Guardian on privacy, free speech, and national security. He has contributed to The Atlantic, Al Jazeera, Foreign Policy, Harvard Law and Policy Review, PBS, Media Shift, and Politico. We'll talk about the Trump regime and their attacks on the press, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions' recent threats against journalists and their sources. So let's hear the interview I did recently with Trevor Timm.
All right. Recently, and actually ever since the emergence of Trump onto the national political scene and and all the fascism associated with it and his attacks on the press being a major manifestation of all this, it's been very pressing, I think, for people to actually try and figure out what the hell is going on, knowing that it's somewhat dangerous, but trying to figure out, well, what the hell is going on? What exactly is happening? What's going on? And how can you do anything about this? And recently, my assistant producer came along and had found a piece that he really thought was important to read, and it was a piece by Trevor Timm. And Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation and a columnist with The Guardian. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. I want to jump into this right away because I think we're going to be here for quite a while. So let's talk about this. You wrote an essay about Sessions, Jeff Sessions' threats against the press, and it was very important for a lot of people, even thinking, looking at this and thinking superficially, okay, you get it. Sessions is this. He's not, he's a diet, just completely all the way through dedicated fascist, but you don't know exactly how deep it goes. You wrote a very important piece about Sessions and the threat that he poses and what it means. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jeff Sessions has pretty much every week decided to go after one group or another when it comes to their civil rights and civil liberties. But I think one of the really vital issues that only got a bit of attention briefly, mainly because, you know, he does this all the time, but it's his concerted effort to go after the press and their sources. You know, when we think about the Trump administration, Donald Trump is out there pretty much every day of the week, you know, insulting the press, calling them fake news, saying that they're enemies of the people. Yet they are, you know, for all their faults, the best way that we have to hold the Trump administration to account and figure out what they're doing behind closed doors. And what Sessions announced a few weeks ago was essentially a crackdown on journalism, saying that they were going to go after journalist sources harder than ever before, that they were going to potentially subpoena them to testify against their sources in court. And there's even been talk about them, or at least they haven't denied that they may actually go after journalists directly and try to prosecute them. And so I think this has been an incredibly disturbing development that really says a lot about the Trump administration, given how much the press has kind of been a thorn in their side.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that he's a big part of this, is that what you're talking about is he actually does, he spends a lot of time. One, I mean, it's true. Trump has this thing where he's talking about, you know, the fake media, the fake press, all this stuff, the lying media, all of these things. And you've actually made an argument that there's been some very specific things that are actually going on behind the scenes with this. And the things that Trump and Sessions have been attacking are extremely serious in relation to just the existence of a press that can actually, you know, reveal, basically hold some feet to the fire and reveal oftentimes. And frankly, it's not oftentimes not enough, but it's actually very important that people do have these. There is this actually thing operating in society where they can actually expose these things. And some of the stuff that has been exposed around Trump has been very important. Let's talk about that a little. What is it? What's actually been going on there? What is it that he's been aimed at really hitting?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, the Republican Party now controls all three branches of government. If you include the Supreme Court, they have both houses of Congress, and they obviously have the White House. And the First Amendment is really supposed to act as the safety valve when it comes to accountability in government, that the press has the right to publish even information that the government considers classified. And we have seen story after story after story during the first 7 months of the Trump administration showing that the Trump administration is lying about one issue or another, exposing all of these controversial policies before they come out and sometimes forcing them to be reversed and giving the American people all this information about the criminal investigations into the Trump administration itself. And we wouldn't have any of this information if it wasn't for the media and the sources who are willing to put their lives at risk by giving it to them. And so naturally, given that the press is the primary driver in holding the Trump administration accountable, that the Trump administration wants to go after them with all of the powers of the FBI and the Justice Department. And this is where things could take a very dark turn over the next 6 months of the year. If they start using the Justice Department's power to prosecute people who are giving information to the press, to conduct surveillance of journalists, to force them into court and potentially into jail, we may have a whole new situation where, you know, the American people don't find anything out about what the Trump administration is doing, and it becomes much, much harder to even force Congress to do the little that they're doing now.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and it's because it's for a lot of people, they just see things in broken up into little segments. And one of the things I got from reading the stuff that you've run on this is actually this idea that when you watch what Trump is doing, that it's, you know, this thing of going after leakers is one thing. And, you know, people that are actually revealing secrets, you know, and things that are happening that are actually necessary for people to know. And as you say, you know, it's going to be a pretty dark world when people do not have access to the kinds of things that we really need to have in terms of understanding, you know, one, not just what the people that rule the society are doing, but also what people are being called on to do in the interests of humanity, in the interests of stopping just the criminal assault on everything from the environment to whole peoples. I wanted to ask you this. When you watch Trump, there's a vicious way, you know, there's a way that he has carried this whole thing out. There's a whole lot of expressions of what you were just talking about. And when you watch him, there's a very vicious way that he goes after reporters at a press conference at Trump Tower or the rally in Phoenix, which was, you know, really can only be described as sort of a Nuremberg rally. There's something that he goes out there, something that no other president in recent memory anyway has done. Let's talk about some of the broad elements of the anti-press strategy as you see them before we get into anything else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every president in modern history has criticized the press in one way or another, but it certainly seems that Trump has taken it to a whole new level where he is, you know, at campaign rallies, making whole sections of his speech about even individual members of the press, actually calling out people by name. I mean, there was a rally last Tuesday in Phoenix where he was he called journalists, quote, sick people who don't like our country. And quote, they're trying to take away our history and our heritage. He's basically calling them anti-American and has even referred to them as the, quote, enemy of the American people. And the reason that he's doing this is because he is trying to delegitimize reporters so much in his supporters' eyes that when these damning stories come out about him, that he wants a large segment of the population to never even consider whether these stories are actually true, to almost dismiss them before they even read them. And if he can get, you know, his 35 or 40% of his the country who supports him to totally discount the press, then it doesn't matter in some respects what they end up finding out about it and what they end up publishing. And so it's certainly a concerted strategy on his part to, you know, help his cause. But what it's really doing is kind of destroying the fabric of the First Amendment and the traditions we have of a free press in this country. And depending on how he takes this fight, we could be in for some dark days ahead.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and he's a columnist with The Guardian newspaper. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, too, is that, you know, when you think about this, Obama, for instance, this is not unprecedented in terms of there's never been these attacks on the press. And one of the things that, you know, that I found in some of the stuff that you've written and other places is that Obama himself, the Obama administration, actually laid the foundation for a lot of what Trump is doing. Can you explain that, how that played out, and then what's the difference between what Obama was doing and what Trump is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think this is actually one of the most tragic parts of the Obama legacy. You know, he came in to office in 2008 and 2009, actually campaigning on protecting whistleblowers and being the most transparent administration ever. But what happened... and with Obama, it was really kind of behind the scenes and low key. You know, his Justice Department ended up prosecuting more sources of journalists than any other administration in history. There were several scandals in his first administration and the beginning of the second where they were spying on journalists. For example, they were spying on 20 Associated Press phone lines that affected over 100 reporters in one case. And it was incredibly damaging to press freedom. But this largely happened without the kind of bombast and rhetoric that Trump is using now. You know, it wasn't like Obama was going out in campaign rallies and insulting members of the press ad hominem. And so it didn't receive as much of attention. And now, you know, we're certainly seeing Trump take the rhetoric to the next level. But if he decides to go forward with this legal crackdown on sources and journalists, it will largely be on the back of precedent that was established during the Obama administration. And certainly, if they go down this road, I think that the Obama Justice Department will share at least part of the blame for normalizing this type of behavior. Now, Trump could also take this to the next level in the legal sense, you know, bringing even more prosecutions and even going after journalists directly. But I certainly do think that the Obama administration will share a part of the blame when this inevitable crackdown happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, that comes out after all this is, you know, there is this point of Trump actually did, when you look at what Trump did, he actually did ask Comey to jail whistleblowers. And that was a fairly important step in relation to, you know, what's been going on in relation to people who are leaking things to the press and people even being able to or feeling confident enough that they can bring something that they think is essential, you know, for the citizenry to know and to understand about. That's actually something that has been sort of sacred for a long time, even though presidents weren't, you know, always happy about it. The kind of assault that's been unleashed against this is very, very heavy. And I think I'd like to talk about that a little bit because it's actually a place where Trump can swing a very large hammer and cause a lot of damage in relation to this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there has been a general consensus that even if the U.S. government decides to go after the sources of journalists and the sources of information and try to put them in jail, well, I personally think that that's very disturbing and shouldn't be done either. There has been this consensus that going after the journalists directly and throwing them in jail would be a violation of the First Amendment. But as you said, we know that actually that Donald Trump had a conversation with the fired FBI director, James Comey, where he implored the FBI director to, quote, jail journalists. And, you know, there is a law on the books, the Espionage Act, which is 100 years old and was written during World War I to go after spies and saboteurs, which has kind of been warped into this anti-leaking law, which is written so broadly that it actually could be used, if you take the letter of the law, to go after not only journalists, but everybody who reads information in the newspaper that the government considers secret. And so this is an incredibly dangerous and, in my mind, unconstitutional law, but one which, if the Trump administration wants to take this fight to the next level, they could try to use against journalists. And it would be incredibly dangerous, not just for these sources, but for the hundreds and hundreds of reporters in the country who report on this information all the time.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Trevor Timm. Trevor is the executive director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, and he's a columnist with The Guardian newspaper. And really to think, too, about the impact. I mean, think about all the things, all the major things that have happened in the world over these, you know, at least, you know, over the last, you know, who knows how many years. But I'm talking about even within my lifetime, which spans a number of decades. Let's just leave it at that. But, you know, the idea that so much that was revealed that actually helped people understand some of how the system operates. And it's also can come to conclusions about what they needed to do in the face of that. And without this kind of, you know, ability to learn about what was actually happening, it's sort of, you have something that is a model of the various, you know, the basically the archetypal fascist regime, that, you know, the thing that actually says that the hammer and the gun, and that's it. Shut up and keep your head down, do work, obey everything, and chew your Cheerios and everything will be fine. Just don't worry about it. I mean, it's a very heavy thing developing here.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of people aren't aware of how much information that the government actually considers secret. You know, it's not just nuclear codes and covert operatives. It is a giant wealth of information that encompasses basically everything the government does in foreign policy and national security. And, you know, when you think back to, like you said, pretty much all of the major investigations that journalists have done in our lifetime, whether we're talking about the Pentagon Papers during the Nixon administration, warrantless wiretapping during the Bush administration, CIA torture during the Bush administration, drone strikes, the Snowden, Edward Snowden NSA disclosures during Obama, all of this stuff, you know, a lot of people consider outright illegal, yet the government thinks that they can keep it secret from the American public. And we have to understand that without the ability of reporters to report on this type of information, the U.S. government could get away with literally anything that they wanted by just stamping a top secret logo on the top of documents. And the First Amendment is meant to protect us against that threat.
Mm-hmm. So just speaking brutally and frankly, where the hell are we?
Well, I think it's honestly too early to tell. You know, the Trump is obviously going out there with fire and brimstone, again, insulting various journalists pretty much every day. And the Justice Department held this high-profile press conference where they said that they were going to start put the wheels in motion to start these investigations. But honestly, because they are done in secret, we may not know the results until 6 months or a year from now. When all of these when all these cases actually start to come to light. That's the problem with these leak investigations, is they're inherently secret. And, you know, in the Obama administration, they did all, most of their the worst of the worst of what they did was during the first term, yet we didn't really find out about everything that happened until the second term. So, you know, I think it remains to be seen and, you know, may not be seen for 6 months or a year, but it's important that people are aware of what's going on so that when it does come, that there can be a large protest against.
Mm-hmm. I have 1.5 more questions for you, and it's been really interesting. We're going to have you back again soon. But throughout all of this and everything you've been talking about and the things I've been thinking about since reading about this, you know, this idea of, you know, what Trump is doing in terms of seeking to create a narrative of false victimhood in relation to the U.S. and the rest of the world, in relation to his own presidency and the rest of humanity. And but there's something that's always there's something that you can pretty much rely on stepping up around that, which is that it's all contradicted by the truth, by the actual real truth, which sometimes the press helps to expose and other times it doesn't. Other times it becomes part of the problem. And I'd like to know your thoughts on how this creates the kind of necessity that this creates for going after the what actually the necessity that's created by the situation in terms of going after the real press that's standing up and exposing things that people need to know in a dangerous world like today.
Well, actually, you know what? I think that's kind of one of the interesting things or byproducts of Trump's war on the press. You know, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of times journalists are responsible for exposing the truth, but in other cases, they can help perpetuate falsehoods. I mean, think back to the Iraq War and all of the reporting done that really helped the Bush administration make its case for weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be totally false. But what Trump has done by insulting and castigating and prodding and threatening journalists is that they, in large part, no longer have this symbiotic relationship with the government where they are, you know, issuing press releases for what the government wants to say. They are actually doing aggressive, hard-hitting reporting on the Trump administration, the likes of which we haven't seen in a long time. And so what Trump is really doing could end up backfiring on him. You know, all of his troubles, whether we're talking about the Russia investigation or his all of his advisors being forced to resign one after another, or any of the other conflicts that he's been involved in, really stem from reporting that the press has been able to do, given that Congress has shown no interest in exercising its oversight capabilities. And so, in a way, we'll see how this plays out, but it could be that Trump ends up digging his own grave by taking this incredibly confrontational stance. And I think it would be quite poetic if that's where we end up in 2 years.
If we have 2 years. I'm a little worried about this guy, and how, you know, not a little, very, very, very worried about this guy. Trevor, I want to know just beforehand, I want you to let people know different resources that you can fill them in on, like, for instance, your Twitter, your website, other websites you might think important for people to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. So Freedom of the Press Foundation's website is freedom.press, and I would go there and check out what we do. We write about these issues a lot. We actually just launched a major new project. It's called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. And you can get there by going to pressfreedomtracker.us. And what we're doing with this Press Freedom Tracker is, for the first time, comprehensively documenting every journalist arrest and border stop and surveillance order and camera seizure and a whole host of other press freedom violations inside the U.S. You know, we often think of, you know, the U.S. as having the most protective free speech rights in the world, but what's happened is that this environment has created a situation where all of these things are on the rise. And so we want to document that as comprehensively as possible. And so if you're interested in news on this front, please go there and sign up for our newsletter. And so we can keep everyone more informed and hopefully prevent the situation from spiraling even more out of control than it already has.
All right, Trevor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll definitely be back in touch with you, man, because we got to keep following this up. It's extremely important. All right.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right. Definitely, man. Thanks. Take care now.
See you.
Bye. All right. I've just been talking with Trevor Timm, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation and writer for The Guardian. In addition to the websites he mentioned, you can follow Trevor on Twitter at Trevor Timm, and his last name is spelled T-I-M-M. Once again, that's T as in Tom, I-M-M. As always, I will post all the links on my Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard. It's a hard rains are gonna fall.
All right, that was Joan Baez's cover of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Before we hear the interview with Matt Ruskin, I'd like to give you a chance to hear the trailer for the film, and then we'll go right to the interview after that.
If you focus on your breathing, it'll bring you out of your mind and back into your body.
Come on, come on.
Just know that you are not alone.
Crime today is an American epidemic.
Ain't no killer.
The system doesn't work for people who can't afford to defend themselves.
The whole neighborhood know what happened. The whole neighborhood know you grabbed the wrong guy.
I'm an innocent man!
I don't know you the way a mother should know her son.
Everyone saying you did something. After a while, you start to question yourself.
I'll work for free if you take a look at his case.
How are we gonna afford this?
You want me to leave him?
They're gonna keep me in here until I say I kill that man. You know I would die before I do that.
We're gonna keep fighting for you.
You got your family, you got your life. Why are you still wasting your time on me?
It's not just about you. It's bigger than that.
Colin Warner lived in Texas
or Louisiana. He would have been executed long ago.
Longer sentences, more prisons.
They took everything from me.
More police.
Everything.
I can't just pretend this situation doesn't exist.
Well, this situation exists too.
The truth is going to come out.
Can't leave an innocent man in jail.
I'm going to take you home. It's just a matter of time.
Okay, I'm pleased to welcome to the show Matt Ruskin.
Matt Ruskin is the writer and director of a powerful new film, a film that's just really an incredible film. I've actually watched it 2 or 3 times, really was moved by it. It's a film about the case of Colin Warner, and he's a young black man framed by the police in New York City for murder and locked up for 20 years, a story all too common at a time of slow genocide for black people, a slow genocide that could easily be an all-out genocide. And I'm really pleased to welcome Matt to the show. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Yeah. Let's talk about this. This is a film that actually, when I'm watching it, I watched it 3 times, and I kept thinking each time got a little bit more, but it was also each time it got hard. It got hard, you know, because it sinks in deeper and deeper. And I want to ask you, what compelled you to make this film and, you know, go in the direction that you went with it?
Yeah, I first heard their story on This American Life, which
is this documentary radio show on public radio, and they're just, they're incredible storytellers, and I try and listen to everything that they do. And they did a piece about Colin and Carl, which featured just a lot of recordings with them talking about their experience. And I was just completely blown away, not only by what they had been through, but how they handled themselves. You know, for Colin Warner to emerge from 21 years of wrongful incarceration with his humanity and his dignity, and to come out of it without bitterness or spite, it sounded superhuman. You know, it's just such an extraordinary, he's just such an extraordinary person. And then for Carl King, his friend, who spent more than two decades fighting for Colin's freedom, this is a guy who really, when everybody else gave up, he decided that, you know, he couldn't live in a world where an innocent guy could be left to die in prison. And I think that propelled him, you know, over those 21 years. So I was just, you know, these issues are really important to me. But as a filmmaker, I wasn't setting out to make a movie about the criminal justice system initially. I was just so taken with these two guys. I thought they were so remarkable that I became really passionate about wanting to tell their story.
You know, what really sort of struck me, too, is that there's a point where, I guess, actually, what's her name? Natalie Paul, who plays Antoinette, who is eventually, she's Colin's partner. And she made this point that I thought it really sort of struck me, because she said that it took her a while. And then she realized at a certain point that the problem is that you think of the people who are in the situation that Colin was in as not being part of society. And therefore, you don't see them. They don't really matter. They don't exist. And yet, what came through, even as you're showing that in terms of Colin's sinking or being buried in the prison system and fighting against it, but still nonetheless being in the midst of this hellhole. And yet the more you watch that, the more his humanity emerges. And I thought that was and the more pressing you feel about get this man out. And it's sort of, you know, that you're like yelling for justice. And then at the same time, you're realizing that this is happening to countless numbers of people.
Yeah, countless people. I think one of the things that was so extraordinary about his story, and I'm sure is true of many others, is that he was arrested when he was 18 years old. He was ripped out of his life, and he was a kid. And he was not only a kid, but he had only been in the United States for 2 years. He had emigrated from Trinidad. And so you have this guy who's not only trying to figure out who he is as a person, but was still, you know, assimilating to the United States and that huge transition. And then you put him in one of the harshest environments imaginable. And for him to really become such a grounded and compassionate human being in that environment is just, you know, unbelievable to me. And something that is, you know, really central to the film and what has honestly been life-changing for me, just being around Colin and spending so much time with him over the last few years, just to see somebody who had that level of strength and, you know, was able to live his life in such a principled way. One of the aspects of this story that really blew me away was that after serving 15 years, he came up for parole, and all he had to do, according to the state, was take responsibility for this crime. And he decided that he would rather die in prison than validate their conviction and express remorse for a crime that he didn't commit. And as a result, he spent many more years in prison, not knowing that there would be any end to this. And I just, the clarity and the conviction in that, I thought, it just really made an impression on me. And I think is, you know, really my goal for this film was to humanize these issues and tell the story in the most human way possible and let people walk away from it, drawing their own sort of commentary about these overarching issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a way that, even in what you're just saying, there's a way that actually when you're talking about what Colin does and the moral stand and the brave stand that he took and actually the standing for the truth, basically, I mean, it's sort of like, okay, I could just cop to this. And so many people, you know, I'm sure millions of people, because they're, you know, this is the scale that this is on throughout across the country. Millions and millions of people probably cop to something lesser so they can just get done, get out. And that, you know, that's sort of a way that this sort of, when you step back a minute and you look at this, that's a way that even in Colin's case, that this sort of this soul-grinding, body-grinding machine keeps on rolling on and eating people up. So it becomes, in a real sense, it actually becomes, when people disappear into the prisons, they're cut off from everything, it becomes an actual genocide. It becomes an actual genocide in terms of when you're looking at who's being hit, black and brown people, who's, you know, what's happening to them. They're disappearing inside the prisons. I mean, that's the one thing that Colin kept sort of asserting his humanity as a way, in a certain way, of not disappearing inside the prison, even though everyone around him, it was actually, there was an element of just they became prisoners. They became something other than what they were when they, before they got into these jails.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that you could convict somebody with no physical evidence based solely on the discredited testimony of a child who was railroaded by police. I don't think you could do that. I don't think all the adults in the room, the prosecutors, the detectives, could do that if you don't dehumanize the person you're doing it to. And I think that is true throughout the rest of his experience in the prison system. And I would imagine that there are countless people who don't have advocates on the outside, like Carl King, who just never gave up, or a woman like Antoinette, who devoted herself to fighting for his freedom. And so, in a way, you know, this story is not just about his experience in prison, but the experience of the people who loved him and held steadfast in their fight to get him out of prison.
Mm-hmm. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. I'm speaking today with Matt Ruskin, the writer and director of a powerful and artistically mind-blowing new film called Crown Heights. You know, one thing that came up to my mind each time I saw the film was the Central Park Five, because it wasn't that great a distance between what happened to Colin and the Central Park Five and what happened to them. I mean, it's a decade, but it's like, you know, the same thing's going on. People were still being fed as grist into the mill. And there was a lot of similarities, you know, the demonization of the Central Park Five and the whole way that the system came out against them. And then, you know, that has sort of maybe a louder, but it is actually a very much tied to what happened to Colin.
Yeah, I think what I take from that is just rejecting the notion that this was like one bad apple detective. There's just too many cases of similar to Colin's. When I was scouting locations in Brooklyn, I would walk around and tell people, you know, what we were doing. And I would just describe his case, you know, in very general terms, saying that it was a film about that. And then they would say, oh, I heard about that guy. And then they would describe a different case. And that really hit me, how really it's an everyday occurrence. And while I was writing the script, the New York Times ran a whole investigative series about a different homicide detective from South Brooklyn who had something like 50 murder convictions, 12 of which, you know, there was the same eyewitness who he had paid for her testimony. And so the Brooklyn DA at the time had opened up a review of his convictions and hundreds of others. And, you know, within the first few months, they had exonerated something like a dozen people. So this story is really just a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend a while back who used to refer to prisons as modern day slave ships. And I kept thinking about that, because when you're looking at things like, for instance, the three presidents that each one tried to sort of up the ante of the one before them in terms of, you know, talking about and supporting this kind of suppression, oppression, and repression. And then and people like Pataki, you have all of these things. And it was kind of against that. This is where I thought actually that what Colin did, but then also what Carl and Antoinette did, which you were pointing to before. These were three voices that were fighting to stand up against the dehumanization and actually had to go up against a lot in society, you know, with, you know, lawyers being, you know, these lawyers that actually were, you know, just bozos and couldn't really handle anything. You know, you had one scene in there where a guy was just like, you just felt like getting up and gawking at the screen and slapping his head a couple thousand times, because the kind of thing that was going on there, where it was just like, it was just it's grist through the mill. And when I keep thinking about that, again, as I was saying, the Central Park Five, and then you look at what was going on in the robbing of humanity, and the idea that this is, you know, this is a sort of ongoing thing where people's humanity is stolen from them, and that is the equivalent of a genocide.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening to go back and look at the political rhetoric from, you know, Reagan, Bush 1, and Clinton, who were all in office while Colin was in prison, and to look at their policies, you know, with respect to being, quote-unquote, tough on crime. And to look at it, you know, for me personally, to look at it for the first time through the eyes of somebody whose life hung in the balance, it took on an entirely different sense of urgency. George Pataki in 1995, when he was governor at his inaugural speech, which we include in the film, he talks about how, you know, if he has his way politically, he'll bring back the death penalty and he wants to abolish work release and parole for violent offenders. And he succeeded in large part in doing, you know, the latter. The 24% of violent offenders who are eligible for parole were released in the early 90s, 1991. And then by 1998, when he had been in office for 3 years, that number went down to 8%. And Colin was one of those people, you know, a violent offender who was denied parole.
Boy. Well, we have time for just, I think there might be two more, but we're going to have to push this. And I want to get to at the end. I want people to know where your film is playing. And I really want people to rush out there and see this damn thing. See it a couple of times and then take everybody you know. Let's jump into this. There's a point here where when we're talking about all this stuff that goes on, and, you know, I thought that there's a phrase that comes up a couple of times from Colin that says, please don't let it be a cell. And it's this plea as he's sort of coming out of sleep. But every time it's sort of, you know, just in a very painful way, he's confronted with the sounds of prison, with the sights of prison, with the reality of prison. And I thought that was a really, really important way of bringing to people what this actually means.
Yeah, he told me that he said this prayer. He would hear the morning bell or buzzer go off and he would hear the sounds of the prison. But before he opened his eyes, he would say that prayer. Because as he always says, you know, this felt like a nightmare that he was living, that he just hoped he would wake up from one day. And that really made an impression on me, and it was something I really wanted to find a way to work into the film.
Mm-hmm. And you did, man. You did really, really well. I mean, it's haunted me since watching this. And it's sort of, I think it actually is a thing that people have to take into account. And again, I mean, this idea of the through line, and even, you know, just leaving aside the poetry of the, you know, the prisons being slave ships, except they don't float, but they're filled with the same kind of social, you know, repression that was there in a general sense, and also oftentimes in a real sense, what happens there. And I wanted you to actually talk to me just for 1 minute or so when you look at this, what do you see as the most important thing in relationship to what people need to know about what happened here?
For me, it's just understanding that these are human beings with families, you know, who were a part of a community, guilty or not, when these people are ripped out of their lives and put in these incredibly harsh environments. You know, there is an element to all of it that is inhumane. But with respect to Colin's story in particular, it is just really my goal is that people watch this film, maybe who haven't thought a lot about these issues, and walk away thinking about the human toll that these are people that we're doing this to on a mass scale. And that's really the goal with the film, is that people could walk away having put themselves in the shoes of Colin and Carl and his wife and all the people affected by this, you know, for an hour and a half.
And the massive numbers of people with the genocidal toll continuing to rise, and the massive numbers of people that continue to be thrown into prison. There are probably millions and millions. There's probably millions of Collins either waiting to happen or having happened already. And your film is going to be a tremendous, tremendous asset to people trying to stand up against this and trying to understand what's happening, but also trying to stand up against it and popularize why this has got to end. So thank you very much for this, okay?
Thank you very much. Appreciate
sure, man. Sure, man. And we'll talk to you again, I hope. So take care.
Hope so.
Bye now.
Take care. Thanks.
All right. That was Matt Ruskin, and he is the writer and director of a powerful new film called Crown Heights, a very important film for anyone who gives a damn about what's going on in the world today. They've got to see this. It's a powerful new film about the case of Colin Warner, a young black man framed by police for murder and locked up for 20 years, which is all too common, okay, in a time of slow genocide for black people and people. And it's the story of Colin's friends who stood up for him and fought for decades to bring out the truth. And as you may have noticed, we didn't actually talk about where the film is playing, but it's playing everywhere. Check your local listings. And you can find news of special events like appearances by the director and cast members on Twitter at Crown Heights MOV. And that's at Crown Heights, capital M, capital O, capital V. We're going to take a break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
All right, welcome back. That was Buffalo Springfield with a very appropriate song for this next segment, For What It's Worth. Now, we're going to be joined by David Freeman. And David actually is someone that my assistant producer came across David's a thing that David wrote. And he said, wow, you've got to check this out because there's all this, you know, argument going on about the different forces in the movement against the Trump regime and which one is doing what and who's doing what to who and, you know, how do you confront the white supremacists and all this? How do you confront the Nazis? And David had something really unique to add to this. And so I want to just welcome David Freeman to the show. First off, David, hi, how are you?
Hi, good to speak with you.
You too, man. Well, let's jump into this. What is it that you wrote this piece? And it starts out with the wrong story is being reported, and even progressives are complicit in perpetuating a false narrative. There are only two sides to this. The white supremacists and their Republican enablers are the wrong side. Everyone else needs to pull together despite our differences. What prompted that?
Well, I received a call from clergy in Charlottesville to come to Charlottesville and help them defend against this onslaught of Nazis that they have. I am not religious myself, but I have found that I am really drawn to people of faith who are serious about it and who are serious activists. So I went up to Charlottesville to help them. When I went there, like many people, I had a very poor impression of Antifa. And in the course of standing with these clergy arm in arm against Nazis, we had experiences that opened our minds and hearts to a better perspective on what they were doing. And so I came away from it with a realization that, well, there's just one clear and present evil which all good people should be able to agree upon, and that's white supremacy. And I realized that we have been fighting each other over tactics with as great or greater ferocity than we use against the white supremacists themselves. You know, and I've been guilty of that in the past, but after Antifa and Black Lives Matter saved our lives, I realized that they have a role different from mine. I am absolutely nonviolent, but I respect them and their opposition to white supremacy, and we need to work together and beside each other rather than interfering with each other's fight.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I was going to ask you about is that there's a you basically say that one that what you were left with in relation to this when you were basically literally put in the middle of an ocean of Nazis, and KKK, and it's sort of like that the whole town under siege, all this stuff happening, and you said we could not allow this to become the new normal, which was really important, I thought, in terms of seeing what the terms were, because it wasn't a question so much of what are your tactics, what are you going to do here, what do you think is good, what do you think is bad, but there was actually an overarching question that people had to confront, which is, are you going to allow this to become the new normal? And if you do, what is that going to mean? And then what's it going to take to actually change this?
Well, when it became clear that the police were either unable or unwilling to defend their city from this onslaught of Nazis, somebody has to. Now, in my personal opinion, a massive show of nonviolent force, when we show up in just enormous numbers, much larger than the Nazis, they will back down and we can protect the city. However, there are wonderful organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, which are encouraging people not to show up because they think that encourages the violence. But when 1,000 Nazis descend upon a town and the police do not defend them, well, the Antifa is going to show up. If we as nonviolent folks do not show up, then thank God the Antifa show up to protect these people. I'd rather it was a large number of nonviolent folks. But I'm not going to criticize the Antifa for protecting people when the police will not.
Well, really, you think there were enough examples through history of people who advocate capitulation under the most, nice sounding and all the flowery, words and all this stuff, but they just basically not showing up amounts to capitulation and amounts to opening the door to the fascists taking over, which is, we've seen this movie before, and that's something I thought was really powerful in what you wrote. And you said that basically you have some principles that you said. You said something about that we did not – well, actually, let me ask you this before you do this. Give people just – we have, and again, maybe 2 minutes, as much of a detailed idea as you can to 3 minutes. We'll give you 3 minutes, all right? As much of a detailed explanation as you can of what was it that actually really changed your mind about your relationship with Antifa and what needed to be done. Because I thought it was really important that the last sentence of the piece you wrote said, I really don't know, but I ain't judging anybody, including Antifa, anymore at all if they're fighting for justice. Let's talk about what that was, where that came from.
Well, actually, the most important turning point for me was when 20 of us were standing, clergy, were standing on the stairs prepared to symbolically block the Nazis. And there was a large group of them coming towards us. The Antifa stepped forward to protect us. We asked them to stand down, to back up, and allow us to make our nonviolent stand, even though they and we thought we would be overrun. And they told us, you're going to be overrun. You're going to be hurt. We respect what you're doing. We will back up. They didn't want to back up. They wanted to protect us. But because they respected us for what we were trying to do, they backed up. That was them giving us respect, and I respected that, and I believe that respect breeds respect. Now, the Nazis surged forward, and we were so few that they were able to they could have gone around us. They just shoved our flank aside. None of us were hurt. If they had come straight over us, we would have been crushed. So we regrouped, and this time, a massive number of Nazis screaming, Jesus hates you, and screaming, kill the faggot priests, were charging at us. And At that point, the Antifa basically said, we've had enough, and they surged forward, and they protected us, and they stopped that charge. And I sincerely believe that when they surged forward, they were moving forward to fight to defend us with love in their hearts that was greater than their hatred for the Nazis. So I respect that, and they showed respect to us. That's what changed my heart.
Okay, David Freeman.
Nonviolent.
Okay, David Freeman, an activist in North Carolina. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, that was David Freeman, an activist from North Carolina and one of the courageous participants in Congregate Seville, a group of mainly clergy who confronted the Nazis in Charlottesville on August 12th. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Trevor Timm of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Matt Ruskin, writer and director of the new film Crown Heights, and David Freeman. I'd also like to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer Henry Carson, my production assistant Jeff Pryor, and Teddy Robinson, my engineer. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out now with a really great version of Eve of Destruction from P.E., Public Enemy. Talk to you again next week.
Drums, pride in the spirit.